earmarked for demolition.
Told from the periphery.
Are you living here?
It's just a temporary thing.
A quest for home and belonging.
We're nearly there!
The Wind in the Willows, a weasel's tale. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tomorrow at 3.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 15th of November. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. President Trump says he will sue the BBC for between $1 and $5 billion after it apologised for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches. On Thursday, the corporation said the clip on Panorama gave the mistaken impression that he'd made a direct call for violent action before the January the 6th riots in 2021. But it rejected his demand for compensation, saying the documentary hadn't been shown in the US and Mr. Trump hadn't suffered harm. Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
Donald Trump told reporters on board Air Force One that he'd sue the corporation probably next week. He said they actually changed the words coming out of my mouth in reference to the clip which edited together different parts of the president's speech on the day of the Capitol Hill riots in January 2021. In a separate interview with GB News, Mr. Trump said the edit was so egregious he felt obliged to take legal action. The case now looks set to go to a court in the US for a US judge to rule on whether it can proceed.
People granted asylum in the UK will be allowed to stay only temporarily in a major change expected to be announced by the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood on Monday. The policy is influenced by the Danish asylum and immigration system, regarded as one of the toughest in Europe. Ian Watson reports.
Refugees whose claims are accepted are currently permitted to stay in the UK for 5 years and can then apply to remain permanently. But it's understood Shabana Mahmood will, like Denmark, end the era of permanent protection and send those who've successfully claimed asylum back to their home country as soon as it's considered safe. She hopes her plan will dissuade some from making the journey across the Channel by small boat in the first place. The Conservatives and Reform UK say the shift isn't bold enough and that the government should leave the European Convention on Human Rights, which they argue is a barrier to deportations.
The UK is among a number of countries backing a call for a faster transition from fossil fuels at global climate talks. The plan by the host Brazil would commit governments to a roadmap away from using coal, oil and gas. The talks, known as COP30, have reached the halfway point in the city of Belém, from where Matt McGrath sent this report.
2 years ago in Dubai at COP28, all countries agreed that they would transition away from coal, oil and gas in energy systems. Now here in Brazil, President Lula says the world should go further and develop a roadmap with tangible steps to speed up the move away from fossil energy. The idea has wide support among rich and poor nations alike, but China, India and Arab countries are firmly opposed. A compromise might see agreement on a path to a roadmap 2 years down the line.
A record number of households in England and Wales are on social tariffs from their water supplier to help pay their bills. New data from the Consumer Council for Water shows that reduced rates for low-income households are now used by almost 2 million homes. That's an increase of 22% in the space of a year. Andy White is from the Consumer Council for Water.
The biggest concern for us is these figures go back to the period before the start of this financial year, and we know that in April, water bills increased by 26% on average, which was a huge uplift in those bills. Clearly, that is going to accentuate this problem further.
Water companies say they're spending more than £4 billion helping customers over the next 5 years. This year's BBC Children in Need has raised more than £45.5 million for charity, £6 million more than last year. Highlights included the Radio 2 presenter Sarah Cox's Marathon Challenge, in which she covered 135 miles, raising £9.5 million. That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute. But first, Sarah Keith Lucas is here with the weather.
Thank you, Alan. We've still got a lot of flood warnings in force, including 4 severe flood warnings across the southeast of Wales. Storm Claudia will be easing away today, but still a bit of rain before it does so. And those flood warnings will take a while to come down, even though the rain is going to ease. So the areas seeing the cloud and rain this morning are across Wales, the Midlands, Eastern England, Northern England and Northern Ireland. Right through this central swathe of the UK, expect patchy outbreaks of rain this morning, which will tend to peter out as we move into the afternoon. Elsewhere, there'll be some sunshine, so for much of southern England and for Scotland, a mostly dry picture, perhaps one or two showers, but sunny spells developing here. Quite a brisk easterly breeze blowing today, but it won't be as windy as it was yesterday. And top temperatures will range between around 7 to 10 for northern areas, around 11 to 15 still mild towards the south. It looks like colder air is going to move in gradually over the next few days, but tomorrow, thankfully, a drier day with a bit more in the way of sunshine.
Thank you, Sarah. Now for a look at the morning papers, and the Daily Telegraph says the Chancellor Rachel Reeves is planning to introduce a new tax on high-value homes in the budget. The report says 2.4 million properties across the council tax bands F, G and H will be affected by the move. Ms Reeves has ditched plans to raise income tax, which, according to the Daily Mail, shows she has lost control. Investors lose faith in Reeves' budget, says the Financial Times, which notes a sharp rise in the government's borrowing costs yesterday after the apparent U-turn. The Times calls it the worst day for UK debt markets since July, when the Chancellor was seen crying in the Commons. Rachel Reeves has previously said she will make fair choices to shore up the public finances. The US is planning for the long-term division of Gaza, according to a report in The Guardian. The paper says the Israeli military and other international forces would control a green zone where reconstruction would start, while a red zone would be left in ruins. A terminally ill woman's call for the House of Lords to pass assisted dying legislation leads the Daily Express. Its headline reads, "Show you care and stop delaying right to die law." Peers recently suggested more than 900 amendments to the bill. The Times reports on Waitrose ditching whole frozen turkeys, with research showing that fewer than half of households are likely to eat it on Christmas Day this year. The paper says families are experimenting with gammon, beef and chicken instead, while a growing number are going vegetarian. And finally, the Daily Star says that the former US ambassador, Lord Mandelson, has been caught up in what it calls a new leak scandal after being photographed urinating in public. He's apologised, saying he'd been bursting while waiting for a cab on the street. The Star's headline puns, "It's Peter Mandelson." And that's our look at the papers. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, here's Claire Balding with this week's Ramblings.
Are we going this way, Corinne?
Yeah, we are, yeah.
Great.
Just up to the gate and through the gate.
Oh, look at that. We are recording this on a bright, fresh autumn day. And up ahead of me, I can see the glowing red of an Acer or a maple tree. And there's a birch tree on the right that has those sort of long, hanging, drooping branches like a weeping willow. I think it might be called a weeping birch. We are in the heart of the Cotswolds in Gloucestershire, in fact on the heart of England Way, which is one of the many footpaths and many routes that Corin Fowler has explored during the writing of a book, Corin, that combines really your two passions. It's called Our Island Stories, and the two passions are
colonial history and walking in the countryside.
We will explore your themes more fully. And also with us is Raj Pal, who is the co-author of one of the chapters that you have written, Raj Holding Open the Gate. And we've got this grass footpath ahead of us that's going to take us down and round. We've got a circular route. And if you want to follow us on the map, we are on OS Explorer OL45, which is the Cotswolds, Burford, Chipping Camden, Cirencester, Stow-on-the-Wold. And the grid reference for where we started at the Horse and Groom pub is SP173325. The structure of your book is that every walk explores a different industry and it connects it with an area. Corin, how did you come up with this as a structure and choose your people and your subjects?
I think I really wanted to ground our knowledge of history in the landscape. So I've got a tobacco walk, you know, I've got a copper walk, I've got a cotton walk, I've got a wool walk, and all of these things are connected to empire in really unique ways. And so I thought the best way of allowing that history to unfold was to explore the unique history of each area. but most of my locations were actually chosen by walking companions, who are people that I really admire, including Raj.
I don't believe that.
Yes, it's true. I admire you, Raj, and you do great work. And I wanted to talk not just about what the history is, but what the history means at a human level. And having a walk with a companion and thinking about how that history relates to their own ancestry and their own family stories is a really good way of exploring that.
You're both from Birmingham, is that
right?
We're
both from Birmingham, yes, yeah.
Yes, we are friends, colleagues and neighbours, and our children go to the same school.
And I also act as a semi-permanent cook for her as well.
Oh yeah, he cooks an amazing lamb curry on the bone.
And the omelette yesterday was
delicious. And the omelette yesterday was delicious.
See, those are the sort of neighbours that you need to find and treasure for life. You can't live without it.
And I also need someone to insult me and heckle me at various book events.
That's my job.
Is that what you do? Yeah.
That's how I earn my living.
he's my severest critical friend, aren't you, Raj?
I am, yeah.
Raj, what's your professional background?
I am a curator by profession, but my curation is very, very heavily influenced by my real passion, which is history. I started as modern world history curator at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery. God, I've forgotten how long ago, nearly 30 years ago.
And back in Roman times.
Back in Roman times, yes, yeah. And I now work as a freelancer and collaborate with Corinne quite a bit, mostly on the same wavelength a lot of the time. Not always.
Do you know, I think it's a really important thing to not always be on the same wavelength.
Exactly.
If you're on the same wavelength, you're basically just playing the same tune. You want a bit of harmony, and harmony requires singing different notes.
Exactly. I've learned loads from Raj, and I hope that it's reciprocal.
I have. I always think there's a difference between being nice and being kind. Nice is just being nice about yourself. Kind is when you have to tell somebody they might not find very palatable initially. And I think that's kind of kindness. So that's the sort of relationship that we have, where we are very nice to each other, but we're also kind enough to say, don't be doing this.
Do you notice the ridge and furrow here?
Oh, yeah.
This is the remnants of the old medieval open field system. And that's when families could farm on strips of land, and which were more or less common land. But all of this land was bought up with Indian wealth. And it's quite a late example of enclosure, 1821. So you can see enclosure is literally the privatisation of land and the putting in of hedges and fences and walls.
And protecting your space, that sort of
exactly
defensive, I shall build a wall around this, no one can come in.
Yeah, and I think that that's a very good example of how the history of land ownership and the history of enclosure is intertwined with colonial history. That you would never think that this land was bought with Indian wealth, but it was. So it's all very invisible, but it's actually a relationship that isn't explored very often.
But conversely, this is also a land which we don't really discuss all that much. When we talk about the Cotswolds in this part of the world, Warwickshire, etc., Gloucestershire, we think of very sort of twee cottages and Burberry jackets and so on and so forth. But this is also historically the heartland of English radicalism that led up to the Civil War. The Diggers and the Levellers, two of the great movements of those times, were based around this area. So when Corinne was talking about enclosures, enclosures in a sense gave rise to the Diggers and the Levellers about what the land should be and who it should be for.
Come through another wooden gate and into the edge of a field so we can walk easily three abreast. And Corinne, would you mind, you and Raj, just telling me about the route we're taking and what we're going to go past today?
We are making our way from the village of Boughton-on-the-Hill, and we're crossing these pastures and grazing lands past Seasoncut House and then over to a very pretty village of Longborough, and then we just loop back again from there.
And Raj, is this a route that you selected?
It was a joint decision, but it was also informed by Seasoncut as well, because Seasoncut It's a symbol of a certain something that we rarely see. It's, certainly to my knowledge, it's the only grand house, so-called stately manor, whatever you want to call it, in England, that externally looks like a Mughal, Indian. It's a melange of many things, but it looks very Indian from the outside. Just to tell you a little story, I brought a niece of mine here a couple of years ago, and she was astonished. She lives in Birmingham. She's third generation. She's grown up in Birmingham, born and brought up there. And she said, you know, why didn't our teachers ever bring us to a place like this? She said this is the first time that she realized that she, as a Briton, as a brown Briton, she and her family have a connection with England that goes back centuries, something that she hadn't really thought of. So Sissingode, in that sense, for me, was quite symbolic.
The house was originally a Jacobean house, but it was restyled as a kind of Mughal fantasy palace in Cotswold stone, you know, that honey colour stone that you get, by two brothers, the Cockerill brothers, who went to make their fortunes in India, like many people did at the time in the 18th century, and came back with an Indian fortune, and they restyled the house, or the younger brother did, to reflect the source of their wealth, which is very unusual, because normally you would probably try to hide that, because at the time people were very suspicious of East India Company men.
Clive did, for instance, Robert Clive. He always tried to hide his Indian connection.
Yeah, Robert Clive being Clive of India. And
yes, he consequently may not have done the best job hiding his, Indian connection.
No, indeed. No, the history has remembered his Indian connection. So nobody really knows why they didn't try to hide their Indian wealth. It was very unusual.
And when you say this style, this Mughal style, is that what we think of like the Taj Mahal?
Yes, well, what is interesting about this is that not many people had actually been to India and seen Indian architecture. And so it's a mixture of Hindu and Muslim styles. You can see just there, if you look through the trees, the green onion dome, which is made of copper. And it's got little minarets, it's got peacock arches, and then the gardens are a kind of mini Taj Mahal fountain, and they've got ornamental pools and lots of references to Indian religions. And so you can see it there, can't you, through the trees?
Yeah, I've just got my first glimpse of it. So between the gold and the brown and the red of the trees, and also the green plate-like branches of a Lebanon cedar, I can just see the edge of the house. And it's all the Cotswold stone in places on the corners is almost white now. But these almost like baubles on top of what's quite a square, solid structure. And it makes me think of, you know, with meringue, when you squeeze out meringue and you have that lovely whoosh at the top of it, so you've got quite that, that.
It's very ornate, but it's quite classy as well, because even though it's a mixture of styles, because they had to rely on drawings from the East India Company to design it, to do a building which reflected Indian architectural design, but they didn't necessarily have the knowledge to be able to distinguish between the different traditions of design within India. It sounds like someone's cutting down trees there.
Yeah, I think they are. With big gardens comes, I would think, a team of gardeners.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what we tend to stop at is we say, okay, the money came from colonial India, but we don't really ask, what were they doing out there?
So what were they doing?
Well, the two brothers took two different routes through the East India Company. So John Cockerill went there as a cadet when he was 14, and he ended up fighting East India Company battles against major Mughal rulers like Hyder Ali and then his son Tipu Sultan. And the other brother was a financier. And so you can guess which one made more money.
Although the army wala wasn't poor either, because in those days the tradition was that if once you won a battle, you literally shared the spoils of war. You would have made a big, big fortune.
Is it in private hands now? Who owns it?
The family that owns it are the Peake family, and they are very interested in the Indian history of the house, and they spend a lot of time researching it and making sure that people know about it. So they really visit India a lot, and they're very keen to embrace that history and to tell those stories, which is brilliant. We're we're just coming up to this beautiful ornamental pool, which is part of a series of ornamental pools and paradise bridges that run downhill from the house.
This is really beautifully done with very exotic plants around it, sort of palm trees and things that look like they've brought in from warmer climes.
You can see why this is an ideal wedding venue, but it's also a place where Edward Peake has told us that it has a lot of mixed faith weddings here, very much in the spirit of the story of the house, because one of the brothers, John Cockerill, the older one, he married a woman of mixed heritage, Indian and Portuguese heritage, called Estuata, and she had four of his children. And he actually brought her back here. And they didn't live in this house because they felt it was too damp for their... They both had failing health. But it's also important to remember that empire wasn't just about money. It was about human relationships. And it's about diaspora and people who stay here and remain.
Gosh, when you come across that bridge, past the little pond, you're basically into the field that leads all the way up to the house. So you can see the full structure of it, the columns on each side, but also that beautiful centre, as you said, copper, therefore glowing green. What do we call that?
It's an onion dome.
The onion dome.
Yeah.
And little spring onions on each corner.
Yeah, with the little mini minarets. And then if you look to the right, you can see these little very ornamental features on the house on the right. And then there's an octagonal pavilion, which was originally designed as an aviary. So it's really elaborate looking.
It's very symbolic of the fact that we have a shared history. My grandfather was born in the 19th century. He and his brothers fought on the Western Front in France and Belgium in the First World War. My uncle and many of his cousins fought in North Africa, in Europe, etc., in the Second World War, etc. And there's my generation, and my son, who's 14, born in the 21st century. So, you know, his children will, across four centuries, be able to draw a lineage that connects India, the land of their forefathers, to Britain. This is a desperately needed challenge for us to reimagine what it means to be a Briton, to equate Britishness simply with whiteness is not adequate, and I think we have to have a more inclusive sense of what it means to be British today. Can I just say also, just on the dome, I just can't help this. No half-baked Indian aristo would ever have a copper dome on his palace. It had to be marble. If it wasn't marble, it's not worth looking at.
When you go on this walk, and especially if it's raining, this is quite a nice little stopping off point. There's a little village shop and there's a little village pub, and it's a place where you can go to shelter in case of bad weather.
And every building in this small village is built of Cotswold stone, so it's just got that, with the evening sun or late afternoon sun on it, it looks like butter. We've come right round now to the bottom side of Longborough Church, and that, if I was going to draw a sort of stereotypical English country church, this would be it.
Yeah, exactly. And yet it's got this chapel built onto it that looks very much in keeping with the building, but it's with Indian money. So it's another Indian story.
And we are discussing Indian stories because, in fact, Corin Fowler has written a book called Our Island Stories. So walks all over the country, connecting landscape in certain areas back to trades like the wool trade or the sugar industry. And Raj Powell, who is your companion and the co-author of the chapter on the route that we're walking here.
And I think it's important to say that talking about this history is just adding another layer to our understanding of British history. It's not finger wagging, it's not lecturing, it's just talking about what it is. It's not looking at it through a prism of guilt and shame. It is simply saying, isn't this interesting? And this is part of our inheritance too, collectively. And it somehow makes sense of the world that we live in today because of all these connections in places you would never normally associate with the history of empire. So I really enjoyed writing this book.
Up here?
Yes.
Turn left up here.
This is a bit I'm nervous about. I've written a book of walks, but I'm rubbish at map reading. And the first time I did this walk with Raj, I actually got lost several times.
Cat sitting in the corner of this car park. We're about to go through a metal gate and back into the through the fields. Hello, sweetheart. Oh, not doesn't like the microphone. Thought it was a dog. Walking through this field of, I think, quite pregnant ewes makes me think of the chapter on the wool walk that you've done.
Oh, that was around the beautiful town of Dolgellau, and the connection with wool is that the particular type of rough woolen fabric that they made in that Dolgellau area of North Wales was used to clothe enslaved people. It was the primary market for that woolen cloth was where all the plantations across the Americas. There was such a demand that the cloth that was demanded in one year would have stretched all the way from Wales to Jamaica.
Really?
So that's a huge amount of wool, woolen cloth. Very coarse against the skin and I imagine extremely unpleasant to wear. Yeah, I think we just have to dash through this wooden gate and then hop back again the other side of that
just
hedge.
So
I think you can
it.
See the stile in the distance there.
Corinne, one of the jobs that you've had associated with your incredible in-depth interest and knowledge of colonial history is co-authoring the National Trust's interim report on colonialism and slavery, which was in 2020, that generated a massive amount of coverage and reaction.
What I did there was the National Trust report, it was just an audit of existing peer-reviewed academic research which had been published over the last 20 years or so by experts in country houses and colonial history. And so what we produced was a kind of gazetteer of a list of all the properties which showed what their connections were. And although it's known as the slavery report, it's mostly about Indian history, actually, and colonial administration. But I think the reason that it's difficult to talk about this is the same for every nation, that every nation has got aspects of its history which can be a little bit sensitive and a bit uncomfortable to talk about.
So and it's shame and it's guilt.
Yeah, and I think that it's not very helpful to see it in that way, and that we can learn so much from this aspect of our past. And it's not just a worthy thing, it's just really fascinating as well. I mean, why wouldn't you want to know about the Cockerill brothers and Estuata and their four children jumping all over their furniture and the Indian visitor, Abu Talib? It's absolutely fascinating story.
How did you cope with suddenly being the centre of a report that many people took against?
What gives you strength is the values that you've got deep inside. It gives you a lot of personal courage because if you know that something is unjust and that it's that the work is important and you believe in it, then you have the courage to stand by that work and also understanding that what's at stake is so much bigger than yourself. And I also feel that we're living in times where it's really important to connect with each other and not disconnect from one another, to call each other in rather than calling each other out. So when people did send me angry emails, which they did a lot for a year, I would have a discussion with them. And what it made me realise is that culture wars are so unnecessary and so divisive, and we can talk to each other. And if we remove judgment, then it gives us insight into why we all think what we think, really. And in fact, that whole experience informed the way that I wrote this book. And what, you know, one of the results of all of that discussion and that heated debate around the National Trust report was that I really responded to some of the things that people said. You know, why don't you look at British history, labour history, working class history? And I thought, okay, that's interesting, why don't I? And I wrote this book in response to that thing that was thrown at me so often.
God, isn't she so...
so good.
So sickeningly nice and sweet.
Oh, shut up, Rob.
But also wise, Raj. So I genuinely admire that, because I would have got...
You're right. It was an audit. For goodness sake, it was an audit. I mean, I think she's slightly underplaying the toxicity that she had to go through. I remember it. I mean, we're very good friends in any case, but I think that strengthened our relationship a lot more. A part of that was, interestingly, taking really long walks, which allowed Corinne to express what she was going through. And I felt at that time that was an important role for someone like me as a friend to play, because she really did go through, honestly.
It's quite hard to exaggerate what an onslaught it was, but then that's why friends are so important, and close friends that you trust.
There's been a really good pull up a gentle slope that's made us all work up a sweat. We're nearly back at the pub where we started, and that has been the perfect loop. What's the next venture for you? I hope you're going to be doing something together again.
Oh, definitely. We're going to be doing a podcast called Only in Birmingham, because we want to look at national life through the prism of Birmingham. We think we've got a lot to say, haven't we?
We have a lot to say.
It's a global city.
It's a very global city, and we love it. And our purpose is to reimagine its past so that people today can understand the city better.
Love it. Good luck with the podcast. I hope you'll do some of the episodes while walking.
Oh, yes. We're no doubt walking through the streets of Birmingham.
And eating.
And having tea.
Rabblings with Claire Balding is produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios production for Radio 4, where we'll join Charlotte Smith for a roundup of the week's farming news in a minute. That's after this.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett. For most of my career, I've been on live radio, and I love it. But I've always wondered, what if we'd had more time? How much deeper does the story go?
I remember having this very sharp thought that what you do right now, this is it. This defines your life.
I'm ready to talk and ready to listen.
I'm insulted by how little the medical community has ever bothered with this.
Ready to Talk with me, Emma Barnett, is my new podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
And in fact, we'll join Emma Barnett and Justin Webb for the Today programme in just under half an hour at 7 o'clock. But now on Radio 4, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week, an acknowledgement from the DEFRA Secretary on the sudden suspension of England's biggest environmental scheme.
We recognise that there were mistakes made earlier this year, but we are getting under the bonnet of what happened there, and the department has also learnt lessons from it.
The cider maker buying apples from locals.
If you go into a pub or something and you buy a pint of cider, you think, well, there's some of my apples in that, which is nice.
And we go seeking Scottish truffles.
I find it. Good girl, well done.
But let's start with arguably less exciting fungi, mushrooms. In Northern Ireland, the McArdle family has been growing them since the 1970s. For the past 25 years, they've focused on organic mushrooms and are now one of the major producers for the UK market. Helen Mark travelled to meet John McArdle at one of his sites in County Armagh, where six large padded and insulated polytunnels with controlled atmospheres are in various stages of a production cycle that ensures a year-round supply.
We produce about 20 tonnes of mushrooms a week. This stage here is at the very early stages of the growing process. The compost, the raw materials are got together. They'll be added into a pasteurisation tunnel to kill any diseases that are in the substrate. That takes about a week. And then after that, the spawn is introduced into the compost. And that spawn holds the mycelium, and the mycelium then grows from there.
So I'm stepping into one of the polytunnels where the mushrooms are growing. There are thousands of them. It's like a pebbled path, pure white against the black substrate. It is really striking.
We work on a six-week cycle from we fill the house and we put the substrate on and the peat layer on, then about between 15 and 17 days, depending on whether it's a chestnut mushroom or a white mushroom, then we'll start with getting mushrooms ready for picking. Day 38, 39, then we'll be looking to empty this house here. The house will be steamed out to kill any diseases and refill the house again. that spent substrate, it'll go on to farmers, and especially the organic farmers, because they don't have any fertilizers, so it's quite useful for them.
Why do you have to use peat?
The peat is for water retention. Mushroom is, the majority of it is made of water. Now, there are substitutes for peat that are coming onto market, but they do come at an extra cost. The legislation is going to come in at some stage over the years, but it needs to make sure that it not only applies to us, but it applies to mushrooms that come from the continent and come from Ireland, comes from the EU. Mushroom doubles the size in 24 hours. Whenever the mushroom's ready to pick, we have to pick it. We can't wait till the next day to get it picked.
By hand, mushroom by mushroom. That's quite intensive work.
Yeah, it's very labour intensive. Like, labour costs about 40%. It's a huge cost for us. From Brexit hit, there's been a labour shortage in us. A lot of the workers would have been Eastern European workers. That slowly but surely has decreased. And now we rely heavily on the government's seasonal workers scheme.
And where do your mushrooms go?
95% of our mushrooms go to the UK mainland. There's only three organic mushroom growers across the whole of the UK. Another guy 5 miles down the road is the other organic grower in Northern Ireland. Between the two of us, we do about 65% of organic mushrooms in the UK.
John McArdle there in County Armagh. Well, now truffles are sort of underground mushroom. And while Scotland isn't known for them, one scientist says milder, wetter summers are providing new opportunities. Professor Paul Thomas has set up a company with 5 sites in Scotland. For several years, he's been harvesting the much prized and rather expensive black truffles at another secret orchard site near Edinburgh. Well, that's where Kathleen Carraher met him and his colleague, Gwen Mateer, and her truffle hunting dog, Grace.
We'll find it. So that tells us that there's one. So that little bit of digging. So that's very small one.
Very tiny. What weight would that be?
12 or 15 grams.
What will happen, that truffle?
That will get cleaned up and sent to a restaurant.
Paul, tell me a little bit about the process. How does it work?
So we start with seeds. We take them to the lab, we clean them up, we sterilise them, and then over the period of a year we grow them in a special substrate and we introduce the fungus to the root system. And then we're looking for the what's called mycorrhiza. So the truffle forms this sheath over the root system of the tree, and when it's done that, you can't even wash that off. That becomes really attached. And when that's good and healthy, we plant them out into the ground. The key thing with truffles is that they like high pH soil. So on this site, we had to add a lot of limestone to get their pH high and get lots of free calcium in the ground. So we prepare the sites, plant the trees, and then it takes about 6 years. Here we've used mainly oak and hazel, and that's because when truffle cultivation started in the 1970s, those were the trees they started with. So that's what we've got most background data on. This one we planted, I think we planted 1,100 truffle trees to the hectare. And then in peak production, I think this patch was doing about 80 kilos to hectare, somewhere around about there. I was just looking at Gwen there for confirmation because she's out here all the time. Typically, I think at the moment, they're about £500 a kilo. And they'll increase towards Christmas. And then they're a little bit cheaper earlier in the season. So it's a fairly good return.
I worked quite hard on her finding them and leaving them and not eating them. But her reward is that rabbit fur bowl with some treats in it. And she's very, very foodie, loves her food.
Paul, you're also expanding your research to apply this research to other fungi and wild mushrooms. Is it the same process?
It's a similar process. So it's the same kind of biology. So we have to get them growing with a living tree. But because they're different species we haven't worked with before, there's a lot more we have to learn. And what we're really trying to do there, you can hear the truffle dogs in the background, what we're really trying to do there is develop a really low-value crop, which can be twinned with forestry, so it can produce edibles that people might well know, like porcini or cep or chanterelles. And we're also working with some lesser-known edibles, which could be really productive.
What about the Scottish climate?
Actually really good. So my colleagues at the University of Sheffield have been working on climate modelling so we can look at which species are best attributed to which area.
And you really think that this could be more than just a niche activity in Scotland?
Yeah, I really hope so. I think if we can scale it, the key thing is to get it cheap. So we've got to really bring the cost down. At the moment, it's quite technologically involved, so we've got to get it very cheap and very scalable.
Good girl, well done. Good girl.
Professor Paul Thomas truffle hunting there in a secret location near Edinburgh. Now, warnings that unless we see some serious rain, England will be in drought next year. The Environment Agency says there'll be widespread impacts on farming as well as nature and describes the current situation as precarious. Well, we'll hear more from them in a moment. First, let's look at the ongoing impact of the very dry summer. Potatoes have had a miserable time. Not enough water as they grew and then dry conditions which have made harvesting difficult. Sarah Falkingham has been to see one grower near Malton in North Yorkshire to catch up on the season and see how incorporating organic matter into the soil can retain moisture.
The shutter doors are coming up here on a huge barn and it's full of loose potatoes, and I'm with Andrew Wilson here looking at, this is the harvest of 2025. Just tell me about what's in this barn here, what's storing, where does it go?
In this side of the shed, we've got 600 tonnes of royal potatoes that are contracted to McCain.
So, looking over the last season, 6% yield down on your five-year average, because sometimes the crop was just too hot, it just stops growing. But I know you build in a lot of organic matter to protect the crop.
Resilience is where it's at. We started growing cover crops in 2011, and that's a green cover, oil radish, which is controlling nematodes, oats, which is... it's harvesting light, it's sequestering carbon, and we've got vetch for fertility, and we've got buckwheat for immobilising phosphate. So it's protecting the soil from a battering from the weather over winter. And then in spring, we'll top that off. If we've got some muck available, we'll put muck on it. The organic matter that we're putting into the planted rows is helping to retain the moisture, but it also helps the drainage for when we get too much rain.
So there's shutter going up here on another barn.
Yeah, this is a different variety for a different customer. These will finish up in crisps, those nice little crinkle-cut ones. For chips, you tend to want a longer chip. But for crisps, if they're beyond a certain size, they don't fit in the crisp bags.
Some farmers did have a lot of problems with bruising at harvest, and that whole stuff's gone off to stock feed. Is that just because it was so dry this year?
Yeah, the dryness and lighter soil types can fall through harvest quite quickly.
Varieties matter so much in potatoes, and you've done some trials this year and had really good results, haven't you?
Yeah, we've been growing what's termed trial varieties for quite a long time now, and that's a variety that's been in development for a few years, and they put it into a commercial situation to see how it performs at a great, on a field scale, really, rather than a small plot.
Do you think breeding more drought resistance into potatoes is going to be, you know, more important as we cope with drier summers?
Yeah, it is really important. It's quite difficult when you consider the dry matter of a potato. 3/4 of each tube is made up of water, and that water's got to come from somewhere. But some varieties can cope with a lot less water than others and still produce an acceptable yield.
Andrew Wilson in North Yorkshire, and he and other farmers are being urged to think now about water for next year. The Environment Agency says England's had less than average rainfall for 8 out of 10 months so far this year, and while we have had a very wet week, the Met Office predicts a higher than usual likelihood of dry conditions between now and January. Andy Turner, Water Resources Manager for the Environment Agency, told me farmers have to make business decisions about their water use and water storage.
Much of the East and West Midlands and Yorkshire, as well as parts of Sussex, are still suffering from drought. And there have been the early steps of recovery in the North West, but ongoing pressures from the prolonged period of dry weather, they remain in East Anglia. A lot of the abstraction licences that authorise the taking of water out of the environment to fill reservoirs, they will enable farmers to take water now. And that's why it's really important that farmers take every opportunity to fill reservoirs when water is available. And, you know, there's some very wet weather on the way over the next few days, for example. So we want them to look at taking that as an opportunity and throughout the winter period.
Because it could be by the time we get into even early spring, those abstraction licences will be limited.
There is the real prospect of reduced access to water and some restrictions being in place next summer. So we want farmers to consider their water requirements for next year now and to look at the business risks of not having that water. They shouldn't just hope for rain.
There has been some frustration that farmers have expressed with the Environment Agency and some of the rules, particularly in places like the Fens, where they feel that rivers which are just running out to sea in a very few miles, they should be allowed to take more water out to try and irrigate water-hungry crops.
We've got a programme of work funded by DEFRA, which enables us to work with those groups of farmers to help them explore the options to improve water supply resilience, whether it's more farm storage reservoirs, whether it's making use of drainage water, or whether it's sharing water rights. Those studies in that programme of work, the local resource option studies, they give us the opportunity to work with farmers to help identify, screen and rank the options available to farmers to help improve water security going forwards.
Andy Turner from the Environment Agency. A report this week from the House of Commons Welsh Affairs Committee is calling for the government's inheritance tax on farms to be halted because it says it'll have a detrimental impact on Welsh farming, which is intrinsic to the Welsh economy. Rural communities across Wales, and indeed the rest of the country, have protested against the tax, but as we've heard on this programme, there are no indications that the government will change its mind. It says the tax is fair and will raise much-needed funds for public services. But the report says that the UK government doesn't give enough consideration to the importance of farming or rural communities in Wales. Well, BBC Wales reporter Ellie Rice has been picking through this MP's report and told Anna Hill what she found.
The standout finding really was this call a year after it was announced that changes to inheritance tax should be paused. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, revealed in her budget plans to tax inherited agricultural assets worth more than £1 million, and many farmers took to the streets all over the country. We saw really striking pictures of protests. So the report says that here in Wales, that's caused unnecessary climate of uncertainty and confusion. It says the UK government's approach was complacent and led to an information vacuum. They say in the absence of data or assessments, it's impossible for farmers to plan or to understand the impact that it could have on them, and therefore before anything goes ahead the government should bring forward a Wales specific impact assessment. Leading the charge on that call is the chairwoman of the committee, Labour's Ruth Jones.
We only make up 4% of the population, but our farms are very, very different. Over 40% of Welsh farmers and their families speak Welsh, compared to 20% of the rest of the population. We know that 17% of UK agricultural workers are in Wales. Only 4% of the population, so we've got a lot going for our farmers. We're not saying no to reform, of course we're not. We don't want wealthy landowners getting off their taxes, absolutely not. But our farms are not, by and large, wealthy tax evaders. They are farms created by families and for their families and for our future farming. We need to protect them.
And there's loads more in this report too. It's all about the state of farming here in Wales and what the future's got in store. You heard Ruth Jones there say how lots more farmers and their families speak Welsh compared to the general population here. These are the kind of cultural points they want the government to show they understand. They say future policy decisions affecting the farming sector here must be scrutinised by the Wales office. They say there's a strong case to be made for the Welsh Government to maintain ring-fenced agricultural funding to help provide more certainty. It asked for administrations at both ends of the M4 to work together, especially in supporting young, new entrants to farming. In particular, there they reference supporting tenant farmers. They say it's a vital route into the industry. For their part, the Welsh Government thanked the committee and said it would consider the findings.
So what have farmers had to say about the report's findings, Ellie?
NFU Cymru says it welcomes the idea of pausing inheritance tax reforms. Their chair, Aled Jones, gave evidence to the committee. He said the report is particularly powerful because it comes from a diverse, cross-party group of MPs who've reached a unanimous view. The Farmers Union for Wales said approaching the autumn budget, the Chancellor must take these findings seriously. They said uncertainty over future funding, referencing that ring fencing, risks undermining the long-term sustainability of Welsh family farms. Farms like that of Peter Rees. He's a dairy farmer near Carmarthen. His family have run the same farm since the 60s and over the years have introduced a touring caravan site and much more recently a wedding venue.
The frustrating thing about all this is that it's all investment that we've made in bricks and mortar and employing people, local people, using local food and things like that. And it's coming back to bite us now, because obviously it adds to our capital value. It's really puts a lot of pressure on us now.
We've had a couple of lines in a statement from the Treasury which said it was backing British farms with the annual investment allowance for plant and machinery investments, billions for sustainable food and action to cut EU export costs. It went on to say 40% of agricultural property relief worth £219 million goes to just 117 estates. It says its reforms will channel that funding into vital public services. So with the budget a fortnight away, perhaps many will be hoping Rachel Reeves does heed some of this. But all in all, strong words from start to finish in this report and plenty to chew over.
Ellie Rice from BBC Wales. Well, the budget came up when, 8 weeks after taking up her post as DEFRA Secretary of State, Emma Reynolds faced her first barrage of questions from the cross-party group of MPs at the EFRA Select Committee earlier this week. She wouldn't be drawn on it, but said agriculture was a priority for the government. Over 2 hours, MPs quizzed her about farming profitability, environmental payments, water pollution, fishing policy, border controls and illegal meat. Well, first, Emma Reynolds gave MPs a timetable for reports that farmers have been waiting for, including Dame Minette Batter's review of farm profitability.
We expect to publish the Batter's review before Christmas, the land use framework early next year, the environmental improvement plan we hope to publish this side of Christmas too, and then the farming roadmap would be next year as well.
She talked about agri-environment schemes, in particular the Sustainable Farming Incentive, SFI, which closed to new applications abruptly in March, leaving a hole in many farmers' finances.
We recognise that there were mistakes made earlier this year, but we are getting under the bonnet of what happened there, and the department has also learnt lessons from it. But let me say, on the positive side, there's a lot more money going out the door now in our environmental land management schemes than there was in the previous government. I don't want to be too overly political. I know the circumstances were different, but I just want to say on the positive side, there's a lot of money going out the door to farmers, which is good, and we want to support them. About 50% of farmed land is now being supported by various DEFRA programmes, and I think we've got something like 39,000 farms in the SFI.
Well, biosecurity at the border was also on the agenda. In September, as you may remember, the EFRA committee published findings of an investigation into illegal meat imports. It criticised a lack of resources and action to stop them. DEFRA has just responded to that report, saying it's working closely with the relevant agencies to better analyse and understand the risks, and it's developing a revised strategic approach to tackle the issues identified at Dover. Well, the chairman of the EFRA committee, Alistair Carmichael, said when the committee visited Dover, they were shocked at the conditions border staff were working under. He asked if either the Secretary of State or her senior civil servant had visited Dover. They said it was on their to-do list. And DEFRA's Director General for Food, Biosecurity and Trade, Emily Miles, said some action had already been taken.
As you'll know, we've given £3 million to them this year. I'm looking at whether we can increase that for next year, and we're in discussion with them about that. And we think that that is essential work. There is also work that is done behind the border, so the Food Standards Agency's National Food Crime Unit, which has been collecting intelligence and sharing that with the EU for vehicles that have regularly breached EU trade rules, and the Food Standards Agency, which coordinates the inland local authority operations. So there is work beyond the border, but and I think that's where we want to focus our efforts for the time being.
Emily Miles, DEFRA's Director General for Food, Biosecurity and Trade. Now, this year's apple harvest has been a bumper one, but with a small orchard on a small landmass, the family producing Roquette cider on Guernsey have had to find a creative way to supplement their crop. They hold apple swaps where the community can pick the apples in their gardens or orchards and bring them to the farm in return for money, cider or chutney. Theo White went to Guernsey to meet James Meller, the founder of the business.
We started planting trees in 1998 and it's grown and grown ever since then.
How much do you make every year?
Well, about around 200,000 litres of cider, I'd say. We've got about 15 acres planted with 5,500 trees. But as you can see this morning, we've got a big response from the public who also bring in their apples that makes up maybe 10-15% of the cider.
So essentially, because you're on a small island and you only have space for a small orchard, you've actually kind of enlisted the public.
In the beginning, it was We were short of apples, so we put out an appeal, and since then it's just grown and grown.
Are you getting cider apples from the public, or is it eaters and cookers?
It's mostly cookers and eaters, but the eaters and cookers make a good blend with our own cider apples. A full cider tannin juice is quite a challenging flavour, so it is good to have a blend of other apples with it.
How's the harvest been this year?
It's a phenomenal year. The issue is trying to get it all in and finding enough space for it. We don't want to turn anybody away. We want to take everybody's apples as far as we can. And our own crop is huge.
We're here, it's what, not even 9 o'clock yet. It's probably about 8:45. There's a queue of cars coming up to your barn, and your staff are rapidly unloading them, weighing them. We're in the first car in the queue now. Hello, what's your name?
Reg Harbour.
Well, you've got a very small car. Is it a smart car? And it's absolutely filled to the brim with apples. What do you have?
About 200 weight in here. This is the sixth time I've brought this up.
Oh, my goodness. And what variety are they?
These ones are made Green Slavers, and these are Ramblers in here, the Cookers.
Here we are, another boot absolutely filled with apples.
This is the fifth week I've brought a carload up, and it's just from two Bramley apple trees in the garden.
What are you going to go for? Cider, money, chutney?
It's always cider.
Don't encourage him.
I keep a stash of bottles under my bed, so it'll last me into next year.
On a personal note, what's it like to engage with a business like this? Do you feel like you're part of the product being made?
Absolutely, you do, because if you go into a pub or something and you buy a pint of cider, you think, well, there's some of my apples in that, which is nice.
What were your names?
Mike and Pete.
What have you got in the back?
Lots of eating apples. We don't know the varieties. Labels.
There might be one or two cider apples. All the labels dropped off years ago, so we've forgotten what they were planted.
I mean, you've got what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 dustbins absolutely filled to the brim.
We could have done it five times over. So.
Really?
My name is Emma Nicola Mellor.
So you're manning the desk here. You've got some lovely looking Roquettes products. What do you do once the weighing's been done?
We calculate what we owe the customer. So they have 22p a kilo for cider apples and 19p a kilo for normal apples. They can then come along and choose bottles of cider, brandy or the liqueurs or chutneys, or they can take the cash.
So this is the calculation here, Jackie, being done, is it? This is a huge load. What was the total?
They had 323 kilograms. And you've got £61.25.
Oh, one of those.
Brilliant.
So what are you going to go for with your 61 pounds?
All the apple brandy.
Well, basically, it's Calvados. And it's better than you get in Normandy.
Thank you.
Super, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
That report from Theo White, and I'm now looking at my apple tree in the garden in a whole new light. If I could turn that into some apple brandy, it'd be great. That's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Rebecca Rooney. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
And remember, you can catch up with the Farming Today team each weekday morning at 5:45. Now, it's just approaching 7 o'clock, so let's get an update on the weather from Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Alan. Well, Storm Claudia has brought significant disruption over the past 24 hours. It's brought a slow-moving front that sat across central parts of the UK, and that's just produced persistent rain across parts of the Midlands, Northern England and Wales in particular. So although the rain will be easing away today and the weather will be slowly improving, it is going to take a time for the flooding situation to improve. So we have around 100 flood warnings in force across England and Wales, anywhere from Somerset right up towards Cumbria, including 4 severe flood warnings across the southeast of Wales, and they mean a significant risk to property and to life as well. So we've got 3 zones of weather today. Let's start with where we've got the flood warnings and the rain still. So Wales, the Midlands, Eastern England, as well as Northern England and Northern Ireland. It's a cloudy picture here and we've got rain this morning. It is quite patchy in nature and it's easing northwards. So if you've got the rain first thing, bear with the weather because it's going to improve and dry up into the afternoon. Limited amounts of sunshine, I'm afraid, underneath that cloud and still quite a brisk easterly wind blowing, but not as strong as it was yesterday. Temperatures through this central swathe of the UK, somewhere between about 10 to 13 degrees. To the south of that, so all of southern England, anywhere really south of the M4 corridor, we've got a little bit more sunshine around today. Still a few scattered showers, especially for Cornwall, down towards the Channel Islands as well, but most places largely dry and temperatures 14 or 15 degrees. for Scotland, lastly, and it's going to be a day of sunny spells. A few scattered showers, mainly coming into the northeast at the moment. They should ease away, and actually a lot of dry weather with fairly light winds for Scotland today. Not a bad day, 7 to 10 here. Through tonight, then, any cloud will sink away gradually towards the south. Thankfully, things are looking drier through the night, but it's turning colder. Some frost in the north, but staying in mid-single figures towards the south. Tomorrow does look like the better day of the weekend, so things are drying up. Still one or two showers possible around northern and eastern coasts, but most of us seeing a dry day with some sunshine tomorrow, and then things turn colder through the course of next week.
Thank you, Sarah. The Today programme is next here on Radio 4, but first let's take a look ahead to later on this morning.
Have you ever eaten a cockroach?
No, but I consider that if I did, it would taste like an aubergine.
That cake blew my mind.
Jay Rayner opens the door on a new series of The Kitchen Cabinet.
Life is too short.
Yes.
To peel a pineapple.
Joined each week by an expert panel assembled to answer all your food and cooking questions.
I have much cream and I do not see it as a treat. I see it as an absolute necessity.
The Kitchen Cabinet with Jay Rayner.
This isn't really just a food question. This is also relationship advice.
Returns this morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Yum, yum, hubba, hubba.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 15th of November. Thank you for joining us at the start of the weekend. This is Today with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning. President Trump says he'll press ahead with legal action against the BBC, despite its apology for a misleading edit of his speech before the January the 6th riots. How serious is the threat?
We'll sue them for anywhere between $1 billion and $5 billion, probably sometime next week.
So you're ready to take
it? Well, I think I have to do it. I mean, they've even admitted that they cheated.
Two other headlines. The government is to make refugee status temporary as part of a major shake-up of the asylum system. And this year's Children in Need appeal has raised more than £45 million.
Also coming up in today's programme, earlier this week I spoke with Caroline Wilgoose, whose 15-year-old son Harvey was stabbed to death at his school in Sheffield early this year. She's now calling for knife arches, airport-style metal detectors installed in all schools. That's what she wants to see. How has it come to this? Do they work? More at 10 to 8. Plotting, briefing and a possible leadership challenge. What's really going on with Labour in the week where Downing Street was accused of a major own goal? We'll try to get to the bottom of that. And one more time, I'm gonna celebrate. Oh yeah, all right. Don't stop the dancing. As Daft Punk's legendary One More Times turns 25, we'll consider what impact the French electronic duo have had on dance music. That's after 8 o'clock.
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday sport as England fast bowler Mark Wood is past fit after going off with a hamstring worry in their warm-up match in Perth against the England Lions. That is, of course, ahead of the Ashes, which get underway next week.
And just first now, the BBC News, we can tell you, is read by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said he will sue the BBC for between $1 and $5 billion next week after it apologised for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches on Panorama last year. On Thursday, the corporation said the clip gave the mistaken impression that Donald Trump had made a direct call for violence on the day of the January the 6th riots in Washington, D.C. in 2021, but it rejected his demand for compensation. The president said he would discuss the matter with Keir Starmer over the weekend. Our correspondent Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
In his first response since the BBC apologised but refused to pay compensation, Donald Trump told reporters on board Air Force One that he'd sue the corporation probably next week. He said they actually changed the words coming out of my mouth in reference to the clip which edited together different parts of the president's speech on the day of the Capitol Hill riots in January 2021. In a separate interview with GB News, Mr. Trump said the edit was so egregious he felt obliged to take legal action. The corporation argued that the program wasn't shown in the US and did not cause Mr. Trump harm as he was re-elected. It says the clip was not designed to mislead and formed 12 seconds of a one-hour program that included pro-Trump voices. The case now looks set to go to a court in the US for a US judge to rule on whether it can proceed.
People granted asylum in the UK will be allowed to stay only temporarily in a major change of policy expected to be announced by the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, on Monday. When refugees' home countries are considered safe, the government would return them. The policy is influenced by the Danish asylum and immigration system, regarded as one of the toughest in Europe. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
Refugees whose claims are accepted are currently permitted to stay in the UK for 5 years and can then apply to remain permanently. But it's understood Shabana Mahmood will, like Denmark, end the era of permanent protection and send those who've successfully claimed asylum back to their home country as soon as it's considered safe. She hopes her plan will dissuade some from making the journey across the Channel by small boat in the first place. The Home Office considers this the biggest shift in refugee policy since the Second World War, but some in Labour's ranks have warned against following the Danish approach, which they say resembles the policies of the populist right. The Conservatives and Reform UK say the shift isn't bold enough and that the government should leave the European Convention on Human Rights, which they argue is a barrier to deportations.
The UK is among a number of countries backing a call for a faster transition from fossil fuels at global climate talks. The plan by the host Brazil would commit governments to a roadmap away from using coal, oil and gas. The talks, known as COP30, have reached the halfway point in the city of Belém, from where our environment correspondent Matt McGrath sent this report.
Things move slowly at COP gatherings. It took 28 of these annual meetings before fossil fuels were explicitly named as the main cause of climate change. 2 years ago in Dubai at COP28, all countries agreed that they would transition away from coal, oil and gas in energy systems. Now here in Brazil, President Lula says the world should go further and develop a roadmap with tangible steps to speed up the move away from fossil energy. The idea has wide support among rich and poor nations alike, but China, India and Arab countries are firmly opposed. A compromise might see agreement on a path to a roadmap 2 years down the line. With a week to go, the mood among countries is unusually positive, with many ascribing that to the absence of the US and President Trump.
South Wales Fire and Rescue has declared a major incident in Monmouth because of severe and widespread flooding after Storm Claudia. People have been advised to avoid the area to keep routes clear for the emergency services. Natural Resources Wales has issued 4 severe flood warnings, meaning there's significant risk to life and significant disruption is expected. The US Justice Department says it'll comply with Donald Trump's call to investigate relationships between the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and high-profile Democratic Party politicians, including the former President Bill Clinton. Congress will vote next week on whether the department should release all its files related to Epstein after the House Oversight Committee published thousands of his emails earlier this week. Our North America correspondent Neda Tawfiq reports.
President Donald Trump is trying to control the narrative around the latest Epstein document releases. Emails between Epstein and several others raised questions about what the president may have known about the convicted sex offender's crimes. The president has denied any wrongdoing, and there's no evidence to suggest he took part in Epstein's sex trafficking operation. Mr. Trump criticized members of his party who are joining Democrats in an effort to force the publication of the Epstein files, and now he's directed his attorney general and the FBI to investigate whether there are links between Epstein and high-profile Democrats, including the former President Bill Clinton and the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. They've both denied any wrongdoing.
A record number of households in England and Wales are on social tariffs from their water supplier to help pay their bills. New data from the Consumer Council for Water shows that reduced rates for low-income households are now used by almost 2 million homes. Dan Whitworth from Radio 4's Moneybox programme has the details.
What sort of help people get from social tariffs and who qualifies for them depends on each supplier. The tariff can mean some money or a certain percentage off your bill or an overall limit on how much you can be charged. The number of bill payers getting financial help this way has jumped by 22% in the space of a year to almost 2 million. There are, though, nearly 3 million households now in debt to their supplier, and the average amount owed is £744. These numbers are from the last financial year and so don't cover the record price increases in water bills introduced from April. Water UK says companies are spending more than £4 billion helping customers over the next 5 years, including reduced bills, hardship funds and tailored financial support.
This year's BBC Children in Need has raised more than £45 million for charity, £6 million more than last year. Fundraising events included the Radio 2 presenter Sarah Cox covering 135 miles in a marathon challenge. Sam Harrison watched last night's telethon.
Performers including Sam Ryder, Remember Monday and Lewis Capaldi took to the stage in Salford for the annual television extravaganza. Children, as ever, stole the show. Amongst them, 16 singers from across 15 BBC nations and regions who made up this year's Children in Need choir. There were also children's takeover sketches of popular BBC shows such as Gladiators and The Apprentice with Lord Sugar. By the end of the night, more than £45.5 million had been raised.
That report was from Sam Harrison.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven. Shall we have our first look at the papers and the front pages, most of them concentrating, or at least the more serious ones, on what the Mail calls the Chancellor's lost control. Rachel Reeves last night accused, the Mail says, of turning Britain into an economic laughingstock after she suddenly abandoned her plans to raise income tax. The various other papers have the various ways in which she now seems likely to raise money in the budget. But the overall point that a lot of the papers make, including papers that are not necessarily anti-Labour, is that it's all been a bit chaotic. In fact, the Times asks in an editorial, has there ever been a more chaotic and contradictory run-up to a budget? In the past, volatility has certainly been known to follow the actual unveiling of the fiscal plan. They mention Kwasi Kwarteng's 2022 mini-budget, George Osborne's 2012 omni-shambles as well. But the Times says it takes very energetic political clumsiness to unleash chaos even before the plan has been announced. And the Financial Times, again, not viscerally anti-Labour by any means, says this week's self-generated crisis over the Prime Minister's leadership and a startling budget U-turn have shredded Labour's claim to quiet competence.
A range of other stories dominating this morning. There's this one of the Oxford-educated former history teacher being charged over claims he impersonated a highly decorated admiral at a Remembrance Sunday service. Jonathan David Carley, 64 years of age, allegedly wore the uniform of a rear admiral adorned with a row of 12 medals, laid a wreath and saluted a war memorial in North Wales. The decorations have said to included the Distinguished Service Order, one of the highest awards for gallantry, and the Queen's Volunteer Reserves Medal, which is exclusively for reserves. He was arrested yesterday at his home around 40 miles from the event. Some of you may have been looking at that story. And there are tributes to the journalist Rachel Cook, as she's described in the Times, the omnivorous food and culture journalist, writer and polymath, who wrote with wit and enthusiasm about the pleasures of food and television and celebrated history's resilient women, dies aged 56. And in The Observer, where she was a journalist for 25 years, they call her the heart and soul of the paper, leaving an extraordinary legacy. And let me just, as we have the morning together, point your attention to this study, which says from the morning brew to the evening cuppa, this is in the Daily Mail, tea is very much, of course, part of the daily routine for many Britons. That first cup, can you beat it? Here's the number, though. So much so, we get through 62,046 cups in our lifetime. And yet, and I say this to all of those coffee drinkers out there, I am not amongst you, with all of your rituals and a costly expense, the habit will only cost us tea drinkers £6,622. That's if we drink a typical 2.1 cups a day over the average lifespan of 81 years. So put that in your kettle and smoke it.
Thank you for that. 12 minutes past seven.
We like to get the news for you. Now, at 12 minutes past seven, he's responded. And he's looking for between $1 to $5 billion in compensation. I'm talking about Donald Trump's response to the BBC's apology for how journalists working on Panorama edited his speech. This week, both the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davie, and the Chief Executive of BBC News, Deborah Turness, resigned over the matter. And questions remain about those responsible for the editing of both the Panorama and Newsnight clips, as there are now two clips in the spotlight when it comes to Donald Trump. While you probably were sleeping, I hope, speaking to reporters on board Air Force One last night, as you'll hear from the background noise, the President confirmed he would take legal action against the BBC.
We'll sue them for anywhere between $1 billion and $5 billion, probably sometime next week.
So you're ready to take
it? Well, I think I have to do it. I mean, they've even admitted that they cheated.
In an overnight interview with GB News, President Trump told representative Bev Turner why he felt compelled to press ahead with the lawsuit.
How far will you push it? Because our understanding is they've offered no money whatsoever. They've apologised in a letter, but they haven't offered you a penny in compensation. There was this figure of $1 billion that you may be pursuing.
I think I have an obligation to do it. Look, I'm not looking to get into lawsuits, but I think I have an obligation to do it. This was so egregious. If you don't do it, you don't stop it from happening again with other people. I think you probably have an obligation. I'd like to find out why they did it. You know, it's so bad.
Yeah.
Who thinks like this? And I wonder if they've done it. We'll find this out. You know, the nice part about litigation is we'll find out how many times have they done it to other people. Maybe they did it to me quite a bit.
Well, listening to that and joining us now, Katie Razzle, the BBC's culture and media editor. Katie, nothing it seems that the BBC has said, and perhaps you can remind us of this, as mitigating circumstances, for instance, that the clip was never played in, or the editing of the clips were never played in America, seems to have cut through with Donald Trump.
Yes, hello, Emma. Very clearly not. You're right. The BBC on Thursday, as you were saying, apologised to Donald Trump and his legal team for what it calls an error of judgment, which it says was unintentional. So the BBC's position is it unintentionally created the impression that the Panorama programme contained a single continuous section of his speech. That was the speech made on the January the 6th, 2021, the day of the Capitol Hill riots, rather than excerpts from different points of the speech. And the BBC says that gave the mistaken impression that President Trump had made a direct call for violent action. But the BBC's been saying he wasn't caused harm by this. This was their legal response to him. There was no harm caused. He became president soon after that Panorama programme went out in the UK. So where's the harm? It wasn't seen. It wasn't broadcast in the US. This was the BBC's position. Well, the idea that the BBC didn't mean it got short shrift from the president last night. He claimed the corporation, as he put it, is stupid to say that. And he said, if it's unintentional, you don't apologise. That was his view. And as you heard, he said he was obliged to sue. Now, he didn't go into any of the finer details of that in his GB News interview. But clearly he said much more after he left and got on Air Force One. If you remember, the original legal letter from his team to the BBC had put the corporation on notice for a $1 billion claim if it didn't apologise, retract and compensate him for the harm caused, as he put it. It did the first two. It didn't do the last because, as I was saying, they don't believe there was any harm caused. And now he seems to have upped the sum and is now talking about $1 to $5 billion.
Yes.
And when I interviewed the chairman, Samir Shah, on Monday after the shock resignations, I asked him then what he thought Donald Trump would do. This was before we knew about the letter. He said, we know he is a litigious fellow. Well, the BBC is now only beginning to understand quite how litigious.
What is the next move? Any response from the BBC? I know this happened overnight.
Well, yes, not as yet. I mean, the interview still hadn't been edited by the time the GB News programme went on air. So it was in the early hours of the morning that all this developed. Of course, the BBC will respond, but it will take, I'm sure, its time to consider. We do know so far as of Friday night, no lawsuit had been filed in Florida. The president said that would be happening probably next week. He also talked in that interview. You remember, this is a president who's coined the phrase fake news about much of the traditional media. Last night, he said he's never had anything so fake as the BBC. Now, some of the people I've been speaking to over the last few days have been gaming out this scenario. So one option was, you know, could the BBC, for example, will the BBC ask the Prime Minister to try and persuade Donald Trump to back down? But I mean, based on last night's interview in which he said, as you heard, he'd never seen anything like it and he had to press on because he wanted to find out how many times it had done it, not just to him, he wants to find out why and he wants to find out how many times they've done it, not just to him, he's saying, but also to people like Nigel Farage. Well, look, last week I picked up the notion from many quarters, the idea of using licence fee payers money to offer him compensation was a non-starter. But now, clearly, this is going to get costly if he does sue. It will be, you know, very expensive in legal fees alone. And, well, all I would say is this: it looks like this is only just beginning.
Katie Russell, I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more over the next weeks and months on this as it keeps on. Katie Russell, our BBC culture and media. So we're coming back to this at 10 past 8.
18 minutes past 7 is the time now. How to stop the flow of migrants across the channel is one of the big challenges facing the government. There are plenty of others, of course, at the moment, but this is a big one. And they think they've hit on at least a partial solution, it seems. Billy Kember is our politics investigation correspondent. He's here in the studio, and it focuses, doesn't it, Billy, on what they do in Denmark?
Yes, the Home Secretary to announce on Monday a major shake-up of the asylum seekers. It's also at the Home Office calling it the biggest change to the asylum system since the Second World War. And based, as you say, on Denmark, the change is that those who successfully receive asylum and granted refugee status will now have that on only a temporary basis. At the moment, it lasts for 5 years, and there's then a route to apply for indefinite leave to remain in the country. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, will say on Monday that the era of permanent status is over and that this is necessary to regain control of Britain's borders.
And also, if the country that you have come from becomes a safer country, there will then be an action to return you to it. Is that right? And that could potentially happen at any stage of your life.
That's right. So there'll be regular reviews of someone's refugee status, and if their home country was deemed safe, they would then be returned. That's proven particularly controversial in Denmark, where this policy has come from. There was a plan 4 years ago to remove 200 people to parts of Syria while the civil war still raged. Damascus was deemed safe enough, even though the war was continuing in other parts of the country. And we've already seen criticism from the left of the party about these proposals before this announcement on Monday. They say that they are adopting the policies of the populist right, and we've had criticism too from the right that these policies don't go far enough.
But presumably the aim of the government, though, is that the size of the problem gets reduced, because what it actually does is persuade people not to come. And that's the kind of holy grail, isn't it? We've endlessly talked to ministers about that, not just in this government, actually in previous Conservative governments as well. How do you stop the kind of pull factors that get people to want to come here so badly? And that's the underlying question is whether or not this can do that.
It is, yes. And this is a problem, a policy area that has bedeviled successive governments, as you say, that trying to get a grip on immigration numbers generally, and particularly on the number of small boat crossings, which remain at very high levels this year. The most recent statistics we have showed record highs for the number of asylum applications. So there's clearly huge pressure on Labour to get those numbers down, and not least for them to talk about other policy areas. In Denmark, which has one of the toughest asylum regimes in Europe, asylum applications are at a 40-year low, if you exclude during the coronavirus pandemic, when numbers were obviously pushed down for other reasons. So Labour look at that and see success for a centre-left-led government in getting to grips with this issue. They'll hope to replicate that here.
Billy Kemper, thank you.
Piers began their line-by-line, clause-by-clause analysis of assisted dying in Parliament. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Lisa McCarthy.
Under the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, someone who's over 18 with less than 6 months to live would be able to ask for help to end their life. That request would have to be approved by two doctors and a panel made up of a social worker, a senior legal figure and a psychiatrist. The bill, which covers England and Wales, wasn't put forward by the government, but by the Labour MP Kim Leadbeater. A non-affiliated peer, Lord Tyrie, said he supported its intentions, but thought it was time for ministers to take it on.
What concerns me is that we are now going to try and improve a bill which is demonstrably flawed, with 900 amendments, many of which seem to make sense to me, on the floor of the House between now and Christmas.
He urged the government to adopt the bill, otherwise...
I think attempting to deal with these 900 amendments in this way is going to end up with the bill being talked out.
That's because for the bill to become law, both the Commons and the Lords have to agree on it before the current session of Parliament comes to an end in the spring, which means there's limited time for the Lords to make any changes and iron out disagreements with MPs. A crossbench or independent peer, Lady Stewart, seemed unconvinced more time would help.
The way this particular bill is written has so many flaws that I don't think this House, however long we debate it, can actually get it to a stage where it is legislative fit to be passed.
Peers were scheduled to debate dozens of the proposed changes to the bill on Friday, but as they made slow progress through the list, a crossbencher, Lady O'Lone, noted...
Our duty is to scrutinise this bill. Our duty is not to meet arbitrary timetables and limited numbers of days for committee. We have to do it properly, because on this work that we do rest questions of life and death.
But a former Lord Speaker and now crossbencher, Lady Hayman, pointed out that the bill had already been considered in detail by MPs in the Commons.
We have to do our job properly, but we shouldn't be forced into a position that we're incapable of completing that job by having an enormous number of amendments.
Peers were only due to discuss the bill until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And as that time approached, Lady Butler-Sloss, a crossbencher, appealed to ministers to give over some of the time allocated to the government for debates in the Lords.
Isn't it time the government looked to give some government time to this bill? Has already been said this is one of the most important bills ever to come before this House.
Not to do so, she argued, was unfair to the bill. Ministers have set aside 4 days for this stage of the legislation, and speaking for the government, Lord Kennedy didn't promise any more.
The government remains neutral. We'll not be providing government time for this bill. We'll obviously look when we get to the end of our 4 days of committee. I will then, of course, work in the usual channel, see what other time can be made available from non-government time.
With hundreds of amendments still to look at, the debate will start again next Friday.
Alicia McCarthy reporting. And at 24 minutes past seven, Simon Mundy's here with the sport. Hello again, Simon.
Hello. Yes, and we'll start with a cricket line as Mark Wood has been cleared of any concerns over his left hamstring following a scan in Perth. Ahead of the first Ashes test, which starts next week, the fast bowler left the field on the first day of England's warm-up game against England Lions. But we are going to be focusing on football now, because the National League, which is the fifth tier of the football pyramid, are seeking changes to how things are run. Now, currently, just two teams are promoted up to League Two, and they want this to turn into three, with Chair Jack Pearce stating they simply won't accept the current circumstances, blocking them from parity and fairness with all other professional teams in England. The English Football League, who cover, of course, the Championship Leagues 1 and 2, have the power to approve this, and they say that an additional team going up remains under discussion. All matches in the league will kick off at 3 minutes past three today as part of the campaign. And joining us to talk about this is Steve Thompson, Vice Chair of the National League, Managing Director for Dagenham and Redbridge FC, and also the Chair of the league's Three Up campaign group. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Simon.
So first of all, explain what is happening with these delayed kickoffs and why this weekend.
Well, today is an international weekend, international break, so we're kicking all our games off at 3 minutes past three to highlight the Three Up campaign.
And why is it so important to you that three go up rather than two?
The National League is now the fifth professional league in this country. We're the envy of the world. We're the only country in the world that's got five professional leagues. And it seems unfair that there's only two promotion places. The sustainability of clubs in the National League depend on the pyramid working. And there's three up from the Championship into the Premier League. There's three up from League One to the Championship. There's four up from League Two to League One. But there's only two from the National League. It's not fair. And we're asking the football to put football first and make the parity throughout.
You've described it as a bottleneck. What actual impact does it have on ambitious clubs? I was thinking of Wrexham recently.
Well, Wrexham, Notts County year. That was a fantastic year. Both teams got over 100 points. Mm-hmm. Now, Notts County eventually went up via the playoffs, but they were within 1 minute of being knocked out of the semi-final. Mm. I mean, that would have been a travesty to get 100 points in and not be promoted. Last year, York were 30 points ahead of the third place and lost out in the playoffs. It's fair elsewhere in football. Why not in the National League?
OK, so what about the fans? And I mean fans, you know, across the full spectrum of football in this country. What's their take?
The Football Supporters Association done a poll of all their members. 93% voted in favour of Three Up. 83% of the supporters of football league clubs voted in favour. So the supporters want it. The clubs want it. Even a lot of League Two clubs want it. They see that if they are relegated, that gives them a better chance of bouncing back up. There's 19 clubs in League Two who are ex-National League clubs.
OK, so let's talk about the EFL then. They have the power to make this decision. Have you had any meetings with them? And before you say that, I just want to read a statement they've shared, which is, it's important to stress that this should not be treated as an isolated decision. So that's their stance with various other things going on. So maybe you can touch on that too.
Well, they're in discussions with the Premier League at the moment about how to reorganise the funding throughout football. And they're linking that to this, which seems unfair to us. What is the difference between the parachute money from the Premier League to the Championship and the funding of Championship clubs got to do with National League clubs?
Okie dokie. And do you think this will eventually happen?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm hoping it'll happen. Excuse me, sorry. I'm hoping it'll happen this year.
OK, Steve, thank you very much. Just to add, the EFL have said that an additional team going up does remain under discussion, and all matches in the league will kick off at 3 minutes past three today as part of this campaign. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Simon.
Simon, thank you. Now, to tell us what's coming up on BH tomorrow, here is Paddy O'Connell. Good morning.
Justin, hello, and good morning to you. Well, as we've just heard on today, Keir Starmer and President Trump will discuss the BBC this weekend. We will round up fresh developments for you tomorrow morning. Those political off-the-record briefings are in the spotlight. Should the secret sauce be bottled? We hear how trippers to the New Forest must stop chasing piglets for selfies, and parents and carers should return to the singing of lullabies for babies. BH is tomorrow at nine. Now back to the warm embrace of today.
Yes, it is a warm embrace because I'm going to talk about the weather. Today will be cloudy and breezy in north and central England, North Wales and east Northern Ireland. Sunny spells apparently elsewhere.
The time is just coming up to 7:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Emma Barnett, Justin Webb and Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
President Trump says he'll sue the BBC for up to $5 billion despite the corporation apologising for a documentary which misleadingly edited his comments before the Capitol riots of 2021. Mr. Trump told reporters the legal action would probably come next week. The BBC has refused his demand for compensation, arguing the film wasn't showed in the US and the president had not suffered harm. The Home Secretary will announce significant changes to the UK's asylum system on Monday. Shibana Mahmood is expected to tell MPs that successful asylum seekers will only be allowed to stay in the UK temporarily. If their home country is deemed safe, they will be returned. It's part of the government's plan to model some of its immigration reforms on the Danish system, which is regarded as one of the toughest in Europe. A proposal put forward at the UN Climate Summit in favour of an accelerated roadmap away from fossil fuels appears to be gathering support. The UK is among a number of countries backing the call to commit governments to a roadmap away from using coal, oil and gas. A major incident has been declared in Monmouth in southeast Wales after heavy rain brought by Storm Claudia. Four severe flood warnings remain in place in Monmouthshire this morning, meaning a danger to life is possible. New figures from the Consumer Council for Water show that a record number of households in England and Wales are on social tariffs from their water supplier to help pay their bills. Reduced rates for low-income households are now used by almost 2 million homes, an increase of 22% in the span of a year. And the 2025 Children in Need appeal has raised more than £45.5 million to help children and young people across the UK. Radio 2's Sarah Cox completed the equivalent of five marathons in 5 days to help raise funds, securing £9.5 million.
Alan, thank you for that. It is just going up to 28 minutes to eight. We are expecting, as we were hearing in the news, a major announcement from the government on Monday about the UK's immigration system. Shibana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, expected to restrict the ability of people who claim asylum to stay here for the long term. The government also committed to closing the asylum hotel. So we thought we'd begin this morning with an update on what's actually going on with them. We talked to Sue Mitchell, who investigated them on behalf of Radio 4 and indeed BBC News as well, and is on the line. Morning to you, Sue. Give us an update, or if you can, about what has actually happened with regard to the hotels since we talked to you, which was, when was it? September, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was September. Thanks, Justin. Well, it's difficult to know for sure because I'm not allowed in them anymore. So I'd been visiting over several weeks as a guest of people I'd got to know inside them. What I do know is that security staffing was changed following the programme. I've spoken to people inside different hotels and people who work with them through different charities, and they say access has been heavily restricted now. So we'd shown people cooking in their bathrooms, covering up smoke alarms in response to what they said was poor quality food being provided. And in the days after the programme aired, there were searches of people's rooms looking for food ingredients and cooking equipment. Where that was found, it was confiscated. And one of the people I spoke to, we called him Kadia. He'd been seeking asylum for 9 years and was living at a hotel with his wife and 3 children. I met him outside in the week after the broadcast, and he told me how things had been tightened up.
They do everything is tight for us now. They search in our room, our cell. They looking for the heater for make the cooking. And everything is go hard and hard for us. Yeah. Make me feel bad, make me feel sad. Because no freedom to talk, no freedom to tell about your situation. Is everything is go tight. Yeah. Because they don't want anything from inside the hotel go to outside the hotel.
As you heard, Kadir feels really worried. He's unable to speak to me further. He's worried about the repercussions. And he showed me a letter that he'd received from the contractor running the hotel for the Home Office. It's actually headed warning letter. And it says that a formal warning for bringing me onto site has been given. And a copy of that has been put onto his Home Office file, his file at the Home Office.
Can I ask you briefly about transport as well? Because one of the things you uncovered, and there was quite a kerfuffle after you uncovered it, is the really widespread use of taxis. Do we know now that that has stopped?
It's not stopped for sure. It maybe looks like some of it has been addressed. Overall, the taxi use continues. And you might actually remember that Kadia had a taxi provided for a hospital appointment. It was actually 250-mile round trip. And the taxi driver told him the charge to the Home Office was £600. Now, at the time, the Home Office told me it didn't recognise that figure, but it couldn't tell me the cost of Kadia's journey either. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, announced an urgent review of the use of taxis the day after our File on Four investigation was broadcast. Talking recently to people at several hotels, they say that public transport is sometimes offered now, especially if they're transferring between hotels with a long journey in between. One woman said to me she was offered a bus ticket for a journey, and when she asked if she could have a taxi instead, the taxi was provided. Taxis are definitely still in regular use for things like local journeys, medical appointments, and it's really hard to say how much that use has changed. What we learned in the programme was that the Home Office didn't keep a record of the types of journeys being made. And so far, the Home Office has declined to say how much it's spending on transport at migrant hotels. And the Home Office did actually say to me, just in advance of coming on here, that an urgent review into the use of taxis for asylum seekers will conclude shortly. And they said will ensure value for money for the taxpayer.
Right. OK, well, look, thanks for that, Sue, because here in the studio is Chris Murray, who's a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee. He's a Labour MP for Edinburgh East and Musselburgh and takes, obviously, an interest in all of these matters. Mr. Murray, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Just quickly on the hotels and the use of taxis. It's something you were surprised by when Sue Mitchell revealed it. Do you accept now that there's a proper review going on and the government has at least begun to get a grip of it?
Yeah, you think you can't be surprised by the asylum system anymore and then stuff like this happens. I mean, what this shows you is the contracts for the asylum hotels are really bad for local communities because they're really annoying to the public. They're really bad for asylum seekers themselves, as your report shows. They're actually really bad for the taxpayer. I mean, it's £5.5 billion has been spent on this. The people it's good for are the private companies the Home Office contracted in 2019 to do this. And it is a public procurement scandal of the highest order, as the Home Affairs Committee found out. The Tories signed a contract where basically these three private companies, for some of the contracts there was only one bidder, had carte blanche to set up hotels at enormous cost. They actually made more profit from the hotels than other kind of accommodation and could just pass on the costs to the Home Office with very little oversight, very little scrutiny. The Home Office were over a barrel.
Let's turn to what's going to happen now. We've got this announcement coming on Monday. It's going to be based, we understand, on the Danish system. The key to it seems to be that if you come here and you're granted asylum, it'll never be permanent. If things change in your home country, you will have to go back. Is that acceptable to you?
Yeah, so it sounds like some really significant announcements going to be made on Monday by the Home Secretary. It sounds like Shabana Mahmood is really getting cracking and getting a grip. I actually think it sounds like a potentially very significant positive development in asylum policy, basically because you need to keep reforming the asylum system as times change. It was set up in 1945 when people didn't move around as much. They clearly do now. There is, you know, the parallel would be with the Homes for Ukraine scheme. Actually, double the amount of people came to the UK from Homes for Ukraine as came on the small boats. But there's very little public outcry. There's people are very comfortable with it. And it's because the basis on which that was offered was if Ukraine gets goes back to peace, you can return. So it's actually something we've already got in the UK and a very successful refugee scheme. And also it brings us in line with other European countries.
What about the impact on the refugees themselves? As someone who gets asylum, who can't go back to their country, they're a legitimate asylum claimant, and we as a nation have accepted that. Is it not a cruelty to inflict on them and their family that they know for the whole of the rest of their life, potentially, in this country, there is the threat potentially that they'll be uprooted and sent back?
Well, we'll need to see what the detail of it is. If it's the whole of the rest of your life, then that could be, you know, it's really extended and very difficult, and that's probably not the right way to do it.
So there needs to be a time frame.
Yeah, probably. And the immigration system has different sort of time frame points throughout it. But the point of it is just now is actually once you cross that threshold into being a refugee, which people can do quite quickly, and we're actually trying to speed up that decision, they can then be here indefinitely, but even if their home country returns. The point about it is if you don't make these kind of reforms, you won't get a grip on the system. You'll set up pull factors, and actually then you'll drain public support for it, and that is like the least progressive thing you can do for the asylum system. You need a refugee system that's fit for purpose in the 21st century, and these kind of reforms are how you achieve that.
Do you have a sense that the government has now got a grip of it, or Shabana Mahmood has got a grip of this in a way that is properly a sea change?
So I think that yes is the answer to that. You're seeing across the piece a series of reforms, whether that's upstream working with third countries, especially France, but also Germany, Turkey. That's really significant because, I mean, international immigration is by definition an international phenomenon, so you've got to work with your allies. Also some really significant changes here in the UK, whether that's trying to drill down on the hotel issue, trying to get the backlog cleared, which has been such a huge millstone around the neck of the asylum system. And then stuff like this, you know, changing the terms and conditions, quote unquote, of refugee status actually makes it fairer for refugees here, makes it fairer for local communities, makes it fairer for the taxpayer, and leads to a system that is robust and resilient as we encounter new crises.
Chris Murray, MP, thank you very much.
Thank you.
At 20 to 8, let's now cross to Monmouth, where a major incident has been declared after heavy rain brought by Storm Claudia. You may have been affected by the rain, but there's a whole other degree going on. Alan Thomas, where you are, tell us what you can see, what you've been hearing.
Yeah, morning, Emma. Well, I'm standing in Mono Street in the centre of Monmouth, the main shopping centre. You can probably hear an alarm from a shop nearby still ringing. There is still some water here on the street, but it has gone down quite significantly since the situation here overnight when some cars were practically totally submerged as the River Mono burst its banks. The severe incident was called by the South Wales Fire and Rescue Service in the early hours of the morning. They've confirmed that a number of evacuations have taken place, residents been moved to safety, but a number of shops in the town here have been hit, and we still have those four severe flood warnings in place in this part of Wales on the rivers Mono and Wye, which means that there could be a danger to life. There are problems elsewhere in the county of Monmouthshire as well. A number of roads around Abergavenny are closed because of the deluge that happened due to Storm Claudia overnight, and problems with people who are trying to travel by train this morning as well. National Rail and Transport for Wales are urging people not to travel between Newport and Shrewsbury this morning because of flooding on the line, with a particular warning that it could cause problems to people who are trying to travel to Cardiff this afternoon for the international rugby match in the Principality Stadium.
There you go. But Justin's ears just pricked up at that. I hope it gets a lot better, a lot quicker. Alan Thomas, thank you.
18 minutes to 8.
It looked how I feel a lot of the time. I don't know if you saw this clip that's subsequently gone viral of Russia's first humanoid robot powered by artificial intelligence face-planting on stage during its highly anticipated debut in Moscow earlier this week, after toddling on there to the Rocky theme tune, no less. Quite an entrance and quite a flop in the competitive space of AI-powered robots trying to resemble humans. Questions have since come up about the widening gap between the AI-powered brains of humanoids and their still clumsy human-like bodies. As this gap grows, the industry's facing questions. Can robotics keep pace with AI? Should robotic assistants even be designed to look like humans in the first place? An interesting thought. Professor Matthew Studley is leading academic in the field of robotics and ethics, currently serving as Professor of Ethics and Technology at the University of the West of England, Bristol. Good morning.
Good morning.
A rocky start for this first in Russia.
Yeah, not the best.
What was your response? How's the incident been viewed by robotics experts?
Well, I think, you know, it's par for the course, really. And anything that is first created is going to have teething trouble.
Indeed, but I suppose those questions around, you know, should it even look like a human? Should it be trying to operate like a human? What can you say about that in terms of the thoughts and the evolution of design around this?
Yeah, so there's a number of reasons why humanoid robots are interesting. So obviously there's lots of things we might want robots to do where making it look like a human wouldn't be a good idea. We probably, if we want an autonomous vehicle, we'll design an autonomous vehicle rather than have a robot drive a car. But the world around us is designed for humans. And so if we want to be able to automate lots of different things, then rather than redesigning our world, we want robots to be able to interact with the world that we've created. So rather than having to redesign your production line in a factory, you use your existing machinery, but replace a human worker with something that can work the same machine. It might be humanoid, it might not, but it'll probably have a couple of arms which will be capable of grasping in the same way that a human's arms can grasp. And the more that we want a robot to go around in our environment, the more it will look humanoid. The other reason, of course, is that we all know what robots should look like because we've seen films. And so there's a lot of hype and excitement around robot humanoids, and they tend to attract more investment.
But I suppose those were dreamt up by creatives, and it didn't have to go this way when those who are making and creating in this space started to do so.
No. But the, you know, it's, I guess there's part of it is the practicalities of it, as I've just said. And the other is market forces.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, simply that there's a lot of investment, both emotional and economic, in realizing this sort of science fiction dream.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, that's interesting to unpack psychologically in any case. But what can we say? I know you say there's teething issues. This is to be expected. But the idea that the robotic brain being powered by artificial intelligence developing faster than the abilities of a robotic body, as it were, what do we know of that and where it's up to?
Okay. So, well, first off, the problem of making robots is much, much harder than making AI, because there's physical constraints. You know, you have to build a body. The body is made out of lots of different systems which all need to work together seamlessly, and you're limited then by what materials and manufacturing methods you've got. But there's a fundamental problem, which is that the large language models like ChatGPT and others are operating in a world of discrete symbols, words. You know, the word elephant is always the word elephant, and there's no ambiguity about that. Whereas for a robot to perceive the world using its senses, that elephant might be partially obscured by bushes, or it might be dusk, or it might be the middle of the day, or it might be standing next to something pink, which is reflecting onto it. I'm using the example of an elephant. Obviously, this applies to everything.
Yes.
The sensor noise makes the world ambiguous, and it makes it difficult to cope with. And that sensor noise, then, is being perceived in all of your physical space. And one of the reasons, I think, why Aldo fell over according to its maker, is because of sensor noise in exactly that way. It got confused.
Rocky was too much for it. I mean, we've all had nights like that. But Professor Matthew Sudley, we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you for giving us an insight into where we might be up to with the pursuit, that science fiction pursuit as well for some, and the investment that's going in of humanoids.
8:30. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn.
Good morning. Tonight, Channel 4 will be screening an extraordinary documentary called Hitler's DNA, Blueprint of a Dictator. Its makers have been able to locate a patch of material from the sofa where Adolf Hitler took his own life in May 1945. And from a tiny trace of blood, they say they've sequenced the DNA of the man most people consider to be the embodiment of evil. It can't be denied that the results are fascinating. A deletion in a gene suggests that Hitler had Kallmann syndrome, which can cause delayed puberty, meaning that the well-known song about the tyrant's sexual organs may have had a ring of truth to it. Those who've analysed the DNA also suggest he had a heightened susceptibility to a range of neurological conditions, including schizophrenia, autism and bipolar disorder. It's all very interesting, but for me there are serious risks to such an analysis if people start to jump to the simplistic conclusion that Hitler's DNA accounts for his actions and decisions. I've already seen comments online suggesting that his alleged sexual problems or his possible personality disorders explain his appalling tyranny and the destruction that his actions unleashed on the world. Not only does such speculation stigmatise those who live with the same conditions as Hitler may have done, almost all of whom are decent and moral people, but as the ingenuity of the science in this field increases, and as people become more interested in looking into their own genetic history, there's a growing danger of genetic determinism. Some people may be led to believe that the person you are and the choices you make are somehow preordained by a genetic disposition over which you have little or no personal control. Not only are such conclusions bad science, they also have moral consequences because they strip a person of responsibility for their own actions. Christians have always held that the human person is infinitely more complex than that. The Bible speaks of human life as beautiful and dignified. We are fearfully and wonderfully made in the image and likeness of God. It is also powerfully aware of the human instinct for greed, conflict and hatred, which unmakes that which God has so beautifully made. Jesus is clear that each person is responsible for their own actions and decisions and will be held to account for them. That's why Christians like me rely on the forgiveness he offers. Human beings are not robots. Never mind how hard we try, human life will never be predictable or fully explicable, either by geneticists or theologians. And personally, I'm rather glad it's like that.
And that was Thought for the Day with Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn. It brings us to 8:10.
On Thursday's programme, we were joined by Caroline Wilgoose, whose 15-year-old son, Harvey, was stabbed to death at his school in Sheffield in February of this year by a fellow 15-year-old who had been his friend. It followed a row on social media. What was so striking was how the COVID lockdowns had affected Harvey, according to his mum, becoming a school avoider due to anxiety, spending more time alone online as a result, and how normalised kids carrying knives had become to him and his friends. I asked Caroline if Harvey had been worried about knives in his school, and in her answer she'll refer to a lockdown and just to say this means when schools have had to close because a weapon or something dangerous has been found.
I didn't think so until the lockdown the week before when he said that children had knives in schools, and I were like, as if children are going to take knives into schools. But since then, children have come forward to me and said they know that there's knives in schools. It were on Education Yorkshire the other day that there was a knife in school. And this is why I'm still campaigning about knife archers in every school. We've got to start somewhere.
Knife archers meaning when people walk into school, some kind of security...
Metal detector. Yeah. I mean, they have gone into schools since Harvey because I've been campaigning, but they need to go in every single school as soon as possible. We've got to start somewhere.
Is that where we've really got to? A need for airport-style metal detectors on the doors of all of our schools? That's what she's saying there. Anthony Olesende is founder of Sheffield-based youth violence charity Always an Alternative. I'll come to you in just a moment, but good morning. And Joe Higgins is chief executive of Dudley Academies Trust. They've just introduced knife arch metal detectors and security measures in their secondary schools as a response to the high knife crime rate in the West Midlands. Good morning to you as well, Joe. Can I start? How is it working where you are, and what led you to this point?
Good morning. Well, the awful events in Sheffield in February led us to this point. I used to be a head teacher in Sheffield. I know the school really well. I was horrified to hear what had taken place. And I believe as a school leader, as a leader of a trust now, we have a responsibility to make sure that our safeguarding measures are as robust and as good as they can be.
So how does it work, if you don't mind, just painting a picture? Do you walk into school through what you do, for instance, at the airport?
You do. It's exactly the same as the arch, the metal detector at the airport. So every young person now in two of our secondary schools where we have them installed, we're rolling them out into two others. We have to do lots of estates developments and adaptations to make sure the screens are in the optimum place. We have to train staff. Most importantly, we have to prepare our young people and listen, that their voice was very important in this. And so, yes, every young person entering our school, whatever time of the day, must walk through the, we call them security screen. And they're working really well, their routine.
Have you found anything?
At the moment, we haven't. We didn't have a problem in our schools before putting the screens in, and that wasn't the reason we did it. The reason we have done it is to make sure that our schools remain safe places where our young people can flourish.
Let me bring you in at this point, Anthony. What do you make of this as a development, and do you think it will make students and pupils feel safer?
I think it's heartbreaking, I think. You know, we've got young people that can't go to school, which is a safe place, without the fear of knives. Of course, you know, it's bittersweet. I'd rather them not be there. I'd rather schools focus on the prevention side of things. But putting a metal detector in a school, that doesn't stop a young person from being injured with a knife or carrying a knife, because they could hide it outside the school or get the person travelling to school. So for keeping school safe, I can see why it's happening, but for me it's all about the prevention and trying to stop it before it starts.
Knowing what you know, and perhaps you can say more about why some young people feel like they need to carry a knife, what do you want to see happen in terms of prevention?
I'd like, you know, I understand. So for me to target a lot of young people, schools are the best place because they've got all the young people in the place at the same time. If I was going to target the same amount of young people, but in youth clubs, which have 20 young people, it'd take me years to reach that amount. So I'd like to see schools open up a bit more, have people go in to do talks with lived experience that challenge knife crime from a different point of view, challenge their mindsets, and allow young people to make an educated decision, because at the minute, they don't really understand the consequences of a knife crime. They just feel worried, they just feel scared, and their young brain's telling them to protect themselves, and knife is the answer. Obviously, we know that's not the truth, so we need to make sure that they get that message.
Joe, having people to come in and say why you shouldn't carry a knife, does that happen?
Of course it does. All of those things that we've just listened to happen.
So why is this still happening then? And why is it getting worse?
Because there have been incidents where knives have been taken into school, and look what happened to Harvey. So we have a fantastic education programme. Our personal development programme is incredibly strong, and we have worked in conjunction with the police around preparing to put the screens in and our ongoing education around them. Sometimes we know that, you know, if a young person is worried and anxious and being exploited out in the community, it could be they don't come into school. School is the place where we educate and support our young people to make the right choices that the other speaker today has been talking about. And our young people, you know, unanimously wanted the screens. The screens have additional benefits of also identifying, for example, if there is a vape in a young person's bag.
Anthony wants more in schools. You're going to say what you're doing is strong and you're working with police. But there's something in the middle there. What's getting missed from your point of view, Joe?
I don't think we can afford to miss anything, and I don't believe we are. Our education programme is absolutely fundamental to this.
No, but we still have children carrying knives. Not in your school necessarily so far.
We don't.
No, no, as in children in schools and outside of them are carrying knives, and it's how to stop that.
So there we look at the complexities within society. You know, schools are often required to do an awful lot. We have to recognise that at 3:30 or 5 o'clock, when enrichment activities stop, the young person is back into the community. Sometimes there are huge challenges within the family. And so we are doing absolutely everything possible to support our young people, to educate them. And that does also involve their families.
Yeah.
But Joe, we're going to have to leave it there.
But Joe Higgins, Anthony Olisende, thank you.
In the heart of Zambia.
On BBC iPlayer.
This is the remarkable story of four rival families. Lions, leopards, hyenas and wild dogs. We will see these rivals compete to stake their claim on this land. Some will rise, others will fall. Who will rule?
Kingdom with Sir David Attenborough. Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
Time now for a look at the weather. Sarah Keith-Lucas is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning to you, Emma. Well, Storm Claudia will be slowly easing away. So in terms of the weather, things improving through today, but we have still got lots of flood warnings, even some severe flood warnings in South East Wales. And those flood warnings will take a while to come down in number. So the flooding is going to be ongoing. Some rain around across parts of northern England, North Wales, the Isle of Man, across to Northern Ireland and the far south of Scotland. That's the tail end of Claudia across this zone. If you have got the rain, though, through the central slice of the UK, bear with the weather. It's going to be petering out through the day, staying fairly cloudy and rather damp as well. Further south, though, most places are going to be dry today. There'll be some sunny spells developing across southern parts of England and Wales, and just the odd shower for Cornwall, Devon, perhaps down towards the Channel Islands too. Scotland also seeing spells of sunshine, and especially anywhere north of the Central Belt. Some showers coming in from the northwest, but there'll be fairly few and far between. Now, temperatures today, around average for the time of year, so 7 to 10 in the north, 11 to 15 towards the south, still quite mild across the far south of England. But then through tonight, cloud will clear away towards the south and things will turn colder, a touch of frost in the north. That sets us up for a brighter day, though, into tomorrow.
Thank you very much for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good morning. If you're just joining us, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 15th of November. The headlines. President Trump has said he'll sue the BBC for up to $5 billion despite its apology for misrepresenting the speech he gave supporters before they attacked the Capitol building. How serious is the threat?
We'll sue them for anywhere between $1 billion and $5 billion, probably sometime next week.
So you're ready to take
it? Well, I think I have to do it. I mean, they've even admitted that they cheated.
In a major shift in asylum policy, the Home Secretary is expected to make refugee status temporary. And this year's Children's in Need appeal has raised more than £45 million. And big shout out for our fellow presenter, because we did not do anything nearly as hard, Sarah Cox.
Coming up in the next hour as well, after a week of background briefings and possible leadership plots, how does Keir Starmer stamp it all out? A former Home Secretary, Labour Home Secretary, is going to give his perspective at 8:30. We'll chew it over as well with our political panel. Plus, Bridget Jones immortalised in bronze.
Resolution number one, lose £20. Number two,
drink less.
Very bad start to the year. We'll persevere with resolution to find a nice, sensible man.
Helen Fielding's heroine joins Harry Potter and Paddington with a statue in London's Leicester Square, all to be unveiled on Monday. Helen will be here at 10 to 9. And one more time, I'm gonna celebrate. Daft Punk's legendary One More Time turns 25. What impact will or have the French electronic duo had on dance music?
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday Sport as England go hunting their first win over New Zealand for 6 years when they face the All Blacks at Twickenham this afternoon. That's at 3:10. Now, Steve Borthwick's side are looking to make it 10 test wins in a row. And James Haskell will be joining us in the studio to look ahead to that one.
BBC News read this morning by Alan Smith.
President Trump has said he will sue the BBC for between $1 and $5 billion next week after it apologised for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches on Panorama last year. On Thursday, the corporation said the clip gave the mistaken impression that Donald Trump had made a direct call for violence on the day of the January the 6th riots in Washington, D.C. in 2021, but it rejected his demand for compensation. The president said he would discuss the matter with Sir Keir Starmer over the weekend. Our correspondent Sean Dilley reports from Washington.
In his first response since the BBC apologised but refused to pay compensation, Donald Trump told reporters on board Air Force One that he'd sue the corporation probably next week. He said they actually changed the words coming out of my mouth in reference to the clip which edited together different parts of the president's speech on the day of the Capitol Hill riots in January 2021. In a separate interview with GB News, Mr. Trump said the edit was so egregious he felt obliged to take legal action. The corporation argued that the program wasn't shown in the US and did not cause Mr. Trump harm as he was re-elected. It says the clip was not designed to mislead and formed 12 seconds of a one-hour program that included pro-Trump voices. The case now looks set to go to a court in the US for a US judge to rule on whether it can proceed.
People granted asylum in the UK will be allowed to stay only temporarily in a major change of policy expected to be announced by the Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood on Monday. When refugees' home countries are considered safe, the government would return them. The policy is influenced by the Danish asylum and immigration system, regarded as one of the toughest in Europe. Our political correspondent Ian Watson reports.
Refugees whose claims are accepted are currently permitted to stay in the UK for 5 years and can then apply to remain permanently. But it's understood Shabana Mahmood will, like Denmark, end the era of permanent protection and send those who've successfully claimed asylum back to their home country as soon as it's considered safe. She hopes her plan will dissuade some from making the journey across the Channel by small boat in the first place. The Home Office considers this the biggest shift in refugee policy since the Second World War, but some in Labour's ranks have warned against following the Danish approach, which they say resembles the policies of the populist right. The Conservatives and Reform UK say the shift isn't bold enough, and that the government should leave the European Convention on Human Rights, which they argue is a barrier to deportations.
The Labour MP Chris Murray is a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee and told us he backs the move to make refugee status temporary.
Double the amount of people came to the UK from homes for Ukraine as came on the small boats. But there's very little public outcry. There's people are very comfortable with it. And it's because the basis on which that was offered was if Ukraine goes back to peace, you can return. So it's actually something we've already got in the UK in a very successful refugee scheme. And also it brings us in line with other European countries.
South Wales Fire and Rescue has declared a major incident in Monmouth because of severe and widespread flooding after Storm Claudia. Some homes have been evacuated and people have been advised to avoid the area to keep routes clear for the emergency services. Natural Resources Wales has issued 4 severe flood warnings in Monmouthshire, meaning there's a significant risk to life and significant disruption is expected. Kirsty McCabe is from the Royal Meteorological Society.
More than a month's worth of rain in places. And then, of course, you have the issue where rain falls over the hills and then you get the runoff and then that starts to work its way down the river catchments. And that's what we're seeing now with the severe flood warnings in force across parts of Wales. So really, it's although the storm itself has cleared away now, it's keeping an eye on the after effects as we go through today.
The UK is among a number of countries backing a call for a faster transition from fossil fuels at global climate talks. The plan by the hosts Brazil would commit governments to a roadmap away from using coal, oil and gas. The talks, known as COP30, have reached the halfway point in the city of Belém, from where our environment correspondent Matt McGrath sent this report.
Things move slowly at COP gatherings. It took 28 of these annual meetings before fossil fuels were explicitly named as the main cause of climate change. 2 years ago in Dubai at COP28, all countries agreed that they would transition away from coal, oil and gas in energy systems. Now here in Brazil, President Lula says the world should go further and develop a roadmap with tangible steps to speed up the move away from fossil energy. The idea has wide support among rich and poor nations alike, but China, India and Arab countries are firmly opposed. A compromise might see agreement on a path to a roadmap 2 years down the line. With a week to go, the mood among countries is unusually positive, with many ascribing that to the absence of the US and President Trump.
Water companies say they're spending more than £4 billion helping customers over the next 5 years. President Trump has withdrawn his support for the prominent Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, a key voice calling for the release of government documents on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Calling her wacky Marjorie, Mr. Trump said all she'd done recently was complain, complain, complain. In response, Ms. Greene, once an ardent supporter, accused the president of lying about her. A new children's book written by the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, has been withdrawn from sale. The publication of Flora and Fern, Kindness Along the Way, had already been delayed, but it's now disappeared from the Amazon website, where it was due to be available to buy next week. Sarah Ferguson's representatives and her publisher have not commented. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
I found, after I paid me rent and a few other bills, there wasn't much left for the rest of the month, so that's how I struggled with not being able to pay them. After 6 months of living on my own, I felt like I was in sinking sand.
This year's BBC Children in Need has raised more than £45.5 million for charity, £6 million more than last year. Highlights included the Radio 2 presenter Sarah Cox's Marathon Challenge, in which she covered 135 miles, raising £9.5 million. Performers, including Sam Ryder, Remember Monday and Lewis Capaldi, took to the stage in Salford last night for the three-hour telethon. The comedian Paddy McGuinness closed the show by revealing the total raised on the night.
BBC Children in Need 2025, you have raised an amazing...
And a new children's book written by the former Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, has been withdrawn from sale. Here's our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
The book about a bunny that gets lost in a big city was initially due to be published on the 9th of October, according to a press release in Bookseller. But last month, Waterstones said its publication date had been moved. And now, Nielsen IQ Book Data has told BBC News that the title has been marked as withdrawn from sale at the request of the publisher. Sarah Ferguson stopped being a duchess when her former husband, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, gave up his Duke of York title over his links with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. No reason has been given for why the book has been withdrawn from sale, but one industry source told BBC News that the decision made total sense commercially.
That was Noor Nanji reporting.
Alan, thank you. 8:10 is the time. The Trump White House is talking tough on the BBC after the revelation that the editing of Donald Trump's January the 6th speech for a Panorama broadcast had also happened on Newsnight and was noted at the time on air. What they say is that it is now clear that the BBC engaged in a pattern of defamation against President Trump. The BBC says that's simply not true. They point out that Panorama was not distributed in the United States. They add the programme did him no harm. He was re-elected shortly afterwards, after all. Also, the edit wasn't done with malice. That word malice, very important in American law. And there were plenty of Trump supporters also heard. They point out as well that Donald Trump is a public figure. You have a right in America to say a lot more about public figures than private ones. But the BBC's hope that this would be enough was pretty shattered overnight by Mr. Trump himself. He was talking to reporters on Air Force One. You'll hear the plane noise behind him. And he confirmed he was going to press ahead with the case.
We'll sue them for anywhere between $1 billion and $5 billion, probably sometime next week.
So you're ready to take
it? Well, I think I have to do it. I mean, they've even admitted that they cheated.
And then in an interview released overnight with GB News, President Trump told their presenter Bev Turner why he felt compelled to press ahead with the lawsuit.
Where do you see this going now, President Trump? Do you see this being a long, legal, protracted conflict with the BBC? Would you like to see it
tied
up quickly?
Well, they've admitted their guilt, but they don't have to admit their guilt. It's on tape. You know, I mean, there's nothing to admit. No, I think... Very shortly, we have a statutory period. We've notified them by writing, and I think you have to wait a week. And so that time's coming up. And after that time comes up, we'll sue them. My lawyers say for $1 billion or more. And we'll see how it all works out. But I can't imagine they could do very well in that lawsuit. What they've done is incredible. I sort of have an obligation, not that I want to do it, I have an obligation to do it. So I've been doing this for a long time, and I've understood. And nobody understands the press because, you know, look, I'm the one that explained to people it's fake news. But, and I hate when people say, I understand the press because they're fools, because nobody really understands. The press doesn't understand itself. But I will say, I think I have an obligation to bring a major lawsuit against the BBC because what they did is impossible to believe. You would have never even thought that.
That was President Trump speaking in an interview released overnight. Sam Nunberg was a political advisor to Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. In July 2016, though, Donald Trump sued Mr. Nunberg for $10 million, accusing him of violating a confidentiality agreement. It was later settled. The terms have never been disclosed. Mr. Nunberg gave me his take on the BBC case and what happens now.
Well, I think the BBC should be taking this extremely seriously. Remember, while the president, I'm sure, has been advised that he cannot sue because of the statute of limitations in England, here in the United States, as a resident of the state of Florida, where I speak to you from, he could bring the case here. And I suspect that a case for defamation for editing his speech on January 6 on the eclipse, where it shows that he would be responsible for the violence that day, that case itself would survive a motion to dismiss, meaning that the BBC would not be able to get the case thrown out before it would get to a jury. And at that point, I think a jury here in the United States, and particularly in the state of Florida for the president of the United States, would be quite favorable. I would also point for your audience to understand, he has received major multi-million dollar settlements from Disney for a comment on ABC Network. And also from CBS. And partly those networks were willing to do those settlements because they didn't want to have cases here in the state of Florida.
One of the things with those settlements, though, is that there seem to be wider business interests at stake as well. I just wonder whether that makes any difference and whether, in a sense, Donald Trump might have misunderstood here, because the BBC is unlikely to settle with essentially British individuals' money, licence payers' money, and that he doesn't perhaps fully grasp that?
Listen, I worked for the man for 5 years, and I was around him. He's always been quite litigious. And believe it or not, although he brings, you know, hundreds of lawsuits, let's say, throughout his career, he studies each and every lawsuit. So I wouldn't underestimate what he's been advised. And what I would say, too, is that he is the president of the United States. So it is a catch-22 when you're being sued, even if it's a foreign news service. There is a high threshold for whatever is said about a public figure if it's done with malice. And here he would have a sound argument that if his speech was edited and it would show that he was directly responsible for violence that caused that day, that's a threshold that would get in front of a jury.
What about the BBC's case, or part of the BBC's case, which it would make, which is hardly anyone saw it in Florida? Also, it wasn't meant to be available in the United States at all. Wouldn't that make a difference?
That's certainly an argument in the BBC's favor. And that is something that there is actually mixed rulings across the United States on issues like this. Typically, though, I would say is that typically the plaintiff or the claimant, as you would call them in the UK, you know, they would bring the case where it was exactly portrayed. Now, the caveat with the president of the United States here is the following, is that he could also claim as a private individual that he has business interests in the UK. For instance, he could talk about Turnberry in Scotland. His legal counsel, I'm sure, would be able to make an argument that perhaps would beat that BBC threshold argument of, look, this wasn't even played within the United States. At that point, though, too, the BBC would also have another argument. Well, then the jurisdiction should be in the UK if he's claiming his business interests in the UK were damaged.
The resolutions, the settlements that were made with ABC and CBS, I mean, he certainly got much less than he was asking for and was happy, it seems, to settle for much less. He's asking for between $1 billion and $5 billion from the BBC, which is obviously right. Not going to be paid. I mean, ballpark, what's a realistic figure, do you think?
I think quickly, if you came, it would be high seven figures, something along those lines, certainly under $15 million. It's a large amount of money, but unfortunately, you know, there is this memo that's, I haven't seen it. I don't think it's been publicly released, but there was a memo going along with the Panorama documentary I referred to that says that they knew they actually, there were some concerns about the way the speech was edited. So he has a lot of evidence in his favor. And it's a pretty solid case to bring in front of a jury.
That was Sam Nungberg talking to me overnight. Let us talk now live to Sir Craig Oliver, former BBC editor, of course, but also director of politics and communications for the Prime Minister, David Cameron, when he was in Number 10. Morning to you, Sir Craig.
Good morning.
I mean, I suppose the first place to start, actually, is where we ended with Sam Nungberg, that figure. I mean, they're obviously not going to pay billions of dollars or pounds or whatever, but if there is to be a settlement, even that would be eye-wateringly difficult for the BBC, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think it is a nightmare situation for the BBC. It does clearly believe that it's got a strong case. But really, the problem is that public money could be spent or is going to be spent fighting this or settling this. But I think that the even bigger problem than that, and perhaps more importantly, is that the reputation of the BBC is continuing to take major hits. And if you watch the GB News interview, which happened overnight, the BBC is being positioned by people who wish to do it real harm as a political actor that is willing to manipulate the truth. Trump says on GB News, it's worse than fake news, it's corrupt. And he also raises the prospect of going through the archive to find further examples. In other words, it's open season on the BBC. So I think for several reasons, this is deeply problematic.
I wonder, though, whether that, in a sense, plays to what the BBC seemed to be saying when all of this first broke, which is, yes, it's open season on the BBC from the BBC's enemies, the Daily Telegraph, now Donald Trump. And actually, in a way, and there'll be plenty of Americans who buy into this and who trust and like the BBC. Actually, this is a fight the BBC could position in for truth and journalistic decency against other forces. And albeit that the BBC gets things wrong and admitted in this case that it got something wrong, the idea of obliterating the BBC is not one that would play well with an awful lot of people, not just in this country.
Well, what's really interesting is when you watch the GB News interview, it's pretty clear Donald Trump doesn't understand the BBC, how it's funded, how it works. And it really is considered, I think, when he's talking about it, sort of this minor irritation that's on the side. And he feels that he has to fight because they've traduced his reputation and that kind of thing. I don't think what you're suggesting works. One, because the BBC has accepted that it got it wrong. And then secondly, it does not, as an impartial news organisation, want to be in a situation where it's clearly in one camp against another camp. And I think that's the real problem here. Is a long time ago, the BBC needed to have neutralised this. It should have dealt with this months ago, and it certainly should have dealt with it 10 days ago when the story was released to the Daily Telegraph. Instead, a vacuum was created, and this has become a textbook, casebook example of what happens when you allow, as a major organisation, a vacuum to exist and for others to fill it and to cause trouble for you.
Do you think Keir Starmer can help? Because they're going to talk over the weekend, aren't they? That's what we're told.
I think he can, and I think that Keir Starmer obviously has a good relationship with Donald Trump and following on from the state visit, that kind of thing. It's, you know, been a real positive in terms of foreign affairs relationship with the United States. The problem is that the BBC is relying on the Prime Minister to expend political capital to save its bacon. And I think that, again, is another problem for the BBC. It's like we are literally having to rely on the Prime Minister to try and take some of the heat out of the situation when we should have dealt with this much, much earlier.
We've got to the end of a week in which all of this has swirled around. And, of course, it's not just about Donald Trump. There are other things in the original memo, the Michael Prescott's memo that was leaked to the Daily Telegraph. I mean, you've made it plain that you think it's all very serious. Serious enough that this is an existential crisis, do you think?
I think it is bordering on the existential for the BBC. It's in the run-up to the charter renewal, which is essentially deciding the terms on which the BBC is funded and how it operates. I think that the real danger for the BBC is in the run-up to that period, and indeed the next election, which is a number of years away, is that the BBC becomes a political football. It stands and falls on being an impartial organisation, the ability to hold the ring in a debate. And when it is positioned as a political actor and seen as having a role in that fight, that is deeply problematic for the BBC. It needs to do whatever it can to get this over with quickly, cleanly, and to move back to a position where it is seen as an impartial observer event.
I mean, it's one thing to give that advice, isn't it? But it's another thing to work out how it does that now.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, look, we wouldn't have started here, would we? The BBC is also going to have a Parliamentary Select Committee hearing on the 24th of this month. And the chair of the BBC Board of Governors and Robbie Gibb, who's been brought into this and accused of all sorts of conspiratorial things, is going to run and run and run as a story. And I can't emphasise enough that in the modern world, when you are a major organisation, institutional business, and you have a crisis, you need to deal with it quickly. You cannot take time and allow vacuums to be created, because then you end up in the situation where, as you say, it's almost impossible to deal this without taking further damage.
Sir Craig Oliver, thank you.
It's 22 minutes past eight. The song One More Time by the French electronic music duo Daft Punk is 25 years old, really. Released in 2000 after the band achieved huge popularity in the 90s, it reached number one in the French singles chart and number two in the UK one. It's a great example of French house music's use of audio filters, featuring heavily processed auto-tuned vocals, and Daft Punk, in their rare public appearances, turned up with helmets and gloves to disguise their identities. The music journalist Lisa Verrico remembers them well.
I interviewed Daft Punk before their debut album came out. I met them in Paris, and they were two very lovely, middle-class, very polite indie boys, but they weren't cool, and they knew they weren't cool, and they just wanted to do their own thing. And to me, that's the punk spirit that is in Daft Punk. One More Time, there was very, very few vocals on it, repeated a few times, and it doesn't matter. It's the personality of the song, and nobody else could make that song because it's the personality of Daft Punk. One more time. Probably in my life a dozen songs that I can remember every second of the moment I heard them, what I was thinking, how I was feeling, and one of those is Daft Punk. I'd never heard anything quite like it, and I remember the opening bars thinking it sounded like Mickey Mouse skating. I couldn't compare it to any other music that I'd heard, and I still think that every time I hear it. It's essentially a instrumental techno track that sounds like a shiny pop song, and it doesn't need any vocals. That song is so packed with personality, it doesn't require them. And to me, that is the key of every Daft Punk song. There's so much personality in it. You want to dance, you want to smile. It's like a happy, optimistic pop song that takes you to a different place. Homework, their first album, was like, it was essentially a techno album. It's got funk, disco, gospel, rock on it. It's got Elton John, and the sample of Elton John and Kiki Dee, Don't Go Breaking My Heart. You can't imagine a kind of serious Chicago techno DJ or house DJ or sort of London club producer thinking, I tell you what I'll do is I'll put Elton John and Kiki Dee in a song. They wouldn't dare do it. And I don't think Daft Punk ever thought about it. They just thought, if this sounds good, I'm going to do it. Work it, make it, do it, makes us harder, better, faster, stronger. Kanye West sampled them. People loved the image of Daft Punk. They were never a prolific band. They brought out four albums. They didn't tour that much. And I remember going to see Daft Punk at Global Gathering in Long Marston Airfield in 2006. And I walked into this tent and they came on and they were on the pyramid stage and they had the helmets on. That was the first time, certainly the first time in Britain they'd worn the helmets. The first time they played here for 10 years. And it was absolutely amazing. People just couldn't believe what they were seeing. The lights were malfunctioning. They were making these little triangles with their hands. It was quite cute. When we think of Daft Punk now, that's probably what we think of. with the helmets. If you want to talk about influence, probably more now. I mean, kids absolutely love Daft Punk. You know, there's Daft Punk shops opening up now. I think they're selling more merch now than they ever did in their heyday. I guess it's a bit like the Oasis of dance music, really. They love the mystery about it. Partly the helmets. Of course, that's great branding. They looked futuristic then, and they still look futuristic now. People love that retro futuristic that they looked and they sounded, and nobody else sounds like them. Lots of people are trying, but nobody succeeded. One more time, got me feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate, celebrate and dance so free.
One more time, this got me feeling so free. That was the music journalist Lisa Verrico.
And it brings us to 26 minutes past eight and to the sport with Simon, who has a big guest, big in every sense.
We do. We're going to get to that big guest in just a moment, because we do have a compelling day of autumn internationals in the rugby ahead of us. Wales play Japan at 5, needing to end their 10-test losing streak in Cardiff, because a defeat could drop them down from 12 to 13 in the world rankings, which could then land them with a nightmare draw for the World Cup in 2027. The draw's been made in a few weeks. After that one is Ireland against Australia at 8. Tomorrow, Scotland face Argentina. But first, England take on the All Blacks this afternoon. They're kicking off at 3:10 in Twickenham. Joining us in the studio to look ahead to that match is former England flanker James Haskell. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Now, England haven't beaten New Zealand at Twickenham since 2012. What chance they end that run today?
I think they've got a good one. I think the team looks good. I think, you know, for me, the All Blacks are still a very, very dangerous side, full of talent, incredible individual athletes, so they cannot be underestimated. But I think some of the mystique, some of the fact that these younger players haven't had that losing sort of run against them, I believe that we can do it.
What do you make of the All Blacks? You said they've lost some of their mystique. They're still number two in the world. They scraped through against Scotland at Murrayfield. Not the force of yesteryear, perhaps, but a risk they're being underestimated. I saw the bookies, for example, have England as favourites.
Yeah, it's a massive risk. I tell you why. People believe, because the All Blacks were the most winningest side of all time, that their consistent winning record was next level. No, I don't believe anyone in professional sport at the top level of rugby will ever get to that again, because everyone can beat everyone on their day. I think that just the fact that they were shown they could lose was such a rarity, but actually they are very, very dangerous. I went over there and played. I saw it's their national sport. They have incredible talent. The shirt holds a real level of honour for them, and individually as athletes, when they get the ball, they have the ability to break tackles and offload. So underestimate them at your peril, but I think that England are a match for them and could win today.
What do you make of Steve Borthwick's strategy that's getting a lot of focus, of loading the subs bench with star names and big game experience, Genge, Curry Smith? What do you think of that approach, and how does it make the starting team feel?
Well, first of all, I mean, I got criticised because a lot of South Africans were upset because they've obviously got the bomb squad. I called it the POM squad, and they all came in and said I was stealing them copyright. But yeah, I think, look, as a test player, rugby's changed now to the point where you have to bring different people on at the right time. Everyone wants to start. So I would always feel like I'd been dropped if I'd gone to the bench. But you look at someone like Ellis Genge, the way he was used in those first two games, he was absolutely stratospheric off the bench. He was incredible. I think you have to put your ego in check, do what's right for the team. I think everyone will have trained and had that same level of value. I think it's a very smart move. South Africa, the best team in the world, do it time and time again. Why not follow in the footsteps?
It's done very well successfully as well by some clubs now, isn't it? Yeah. You look at Bath and their strategy last time round. You have, I mean, people like Thomas du Toit coming off the bench, one of the best.
I think that's the nature of the way rugby's gone now. And actually, that might be one of the criticisms as to how you would prevent less injuries, would to stop that happening.
Stop it happening.
Only bring subs on if they're injured, because you're bringing in a whole set of fresh players, which keeps the intensity up. But I think it's very smart. And if the rules are there to be bent, why not do it? And I think England did it so well in the first two games.
Listen, England have won 9 in a row.
Yeah.
So they're going for 10. It's a good run, but they haven't faced opposition like the All Blacks. So if they lose today, it's irrelevant, isn't it?
Well, nothing's irrelevant. But I think, look, we obviously in this country love to do people up and then do people down. I think you've got to be very consistent. This team's had 9 wins on the trot. For me, I'm very positive about Steve Borthwick. I always have been about the players and the talent. But the real test is against the Southern Hemisphere side. If you've got any hopes of winning World Cups and big trophies, you have to beat Southern Hemisphere sides. Eddie Jones, when he was in charge, you know, sometimes Six Nations didn't go well, but he would always win in the autumn. When he started losing in the autumn, that's when he lost his job. I think for me today is a real test to see where they are. They're second in the world. You can beat domestic team or Northern Hemisphere sides all you want, but you have to go and beat people like New Zealand. So I think today is really important. If they lose, does it derail the whole thing? Absolutely not. but it would be a good idea to see where they are, a good benchmark.
James, I appreciate you coming in. Your new book, The Good, The Bad and The Rugby Reloaded, is out now. I know you've opened your heart in it very quickly. Yes. Just a quick, why should people read?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've written more books than a small children's library, actually. So this is another opportunity to kind of go back and talk about, you know, the story of our podcast, the trials and tribulations with, you know, Mike Tindall, obviously being part of a very special family. You know, he's never going to write a book, but his story in rugby, his father with cure Parkinson's, and my sort of talk about my journey as a 40-year-old, and the wheels have come off, but I'm still soldiering on.
And you look fantastic.
I do look fantastic, thank you.
James, thank you very much for coming in, looking ahead to the match too. Kicking off at 3:10.
Christmas sorted, eh, with that book, Emma?
Yeah, well, us 40-year-olds looking great. That's what I'm going with this morning. I'll take it. To let you know what's coming up after us on Saturday Live, let's have a listen to Adrian Giles.
Good morning to you. Really looking forward to today's show. Got four fascinating guests. Got Jasmine Mitchell, who won Bake Off by a country mile while completing a degree in medicine at the same time. Also got a couple of music stars, Holly Cook, whose top song's been streamed almost 50 million times on Spotify. Holly's coming in, and she's dragged her dad out of bed to be with us too. That would be Paul Cook of the Sex Pistols, still going strong, loving being with the Pistols now more than ever. They're a fascinating pair, those two. Also got Ben Giles. Now, he's an extreme cleaner, cleans up crime scenes, all sorts of horrific stuff. It's actually fascinating story, but almost impossible interview to do because most of the stuff he cleans up is too ghastly to talk about. But you know what, Emma? We'll muddle our way through somehow with that. Also got Richard E. Grant's Inheritance Tracks, and it's, well, spoiler alert, but it's all about Barbra Streisand. He's absolutely obsessed, is that man, with Barbra Streisand. There you go.
As there he should be. Any right-minded person should be.
Thanks, Adrian. It's going to be cloudy and breezy today in the north and central England, North Wales and eastern Northern Ireland, but sunny spells elsewhere.
We'll take it. It is 27 minutes to nine. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. Now, a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
President Trump says he'll sue the BBC for up to $5 billion despite the corporation apologising for a documentary which misleadingly edited his comments before the Capitol riots of 2021. Mr. Trump told reporters the legal action would probably come next week. The Home Secretary will announce significant changes to the UK's asylum system on Monday. Shabana Mahmood is expected to tell MPs that successful asylum seekers will only be allowed to stay in the UK temporarily. If their home country is deemed safe, they will be returned. A major incident has been declared in Monmouth in southeast Wales after heavy rain brought by Storm Claudia. Four severe flood warnings remain in place in Monmouthshire, meaning a danger to life is possible. And the 2025 Children in Need Appeal has raised more than £45.5 million to help children and young people across the UK. Radio 2's Sarah Cox completed the equivalent of five marathons in 5 days to help raise funds.
What a legend. It's 26 minutes to nine. In the week that was, to those who don't follow every whisper and sneeze of British politics, you could be forgiven for wondering why the Prime Minister's leadership was suddenly called so definitively into question earlier this week. Briefings to journalists that Sir Keir Starmer would fight any attempt to remove him and that cabinet ministers, including the Health Secretary Wes Streeting, were plotting challenges. Mr Streeting, who happened to be doing a series of interviews just after that, used his airtime to protest his innocence and loyalty to the Prime Minister and called on those behind such briefings to be sacked. Has anyone been sacked? An own goal by Downing Street? That's how it's been described, and yet the man meant to be running it, the Prime Minister, also said that any attacks on his ministers were unacceptable. Where does this leave Sir Keir Starmer's government and what does he need to do going forward? Lord Blunkett, of course, former Labour Home Secretary, on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
It's quite curious when you read it all aloud, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I've always tried to think and react and feel like what you might describe as a normal human being rather than a politician. Sometimes it's quite difficult. I mean, I'm reacting like most of your listeners, which is, for goodness sake, get a grip. This can't carry on. It has implications, obviously, much wider than just the popularity of the government at this moment in time. And I'm being circumspect this morning only because we've got a budget in 10 days' time. It's appeared.
So sorry, Lord Blunkett, your line just cut out there. We've got a budget in 10 days' time. And what did you say next? Oh, I'm hoping we can.
10 days.
Go on.
Appear to be single issue that's thrown. It's made every reaction. So,
Lord Blunkett, we're just going to see if we can improve your line. We might have to come back to you in just a moment. Sorry, you seem to be saying about the budget. Do say again.
I'm saying that the markets indicate it's just have the moment and just have thing that's said or done got for the next 10 days to be say and do.
Lord Blunkett, I'm going to say we're going to try and get you back up now in just a moment, but we'll come back to you in a second, Justin.
Luckily, we have here in the studio Rachel Sylvester, the political editor of The Observer, because we're about to have our political panel with Gillian Tett as well from the Financial Times and King's College, Cambridge. Not sure if Gillian is yet on the line, but Rachel, thankfully, is here, and the line isn't going to glitch because she is actually literally in front of me.
Yes.
Thank goodness. And just on that subject, on what David Blunkett was saying there, that this is, I mean, you look at the headlines in papers today that are naturally not necessarily opposed to Labour and certainly weren't opposed to Labour when they first came to power. And you see a real and worrying for Labour shift, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's just astonishing, isn't it? I think David Blunkett was absolutely right when thinking about this as a sort of normal member of the public, as it were, rather than a politician or a journalist. It's just astonishing and extraordinary. And remember when Keir Starmer was promising to end the chaos and walk a little less lightly, a little more lightly on our lives for politics?
But that's
and it just hasn't happened this week, has it?
There are two levels of this, aren't there? There's a budgetary level. We had Howard Davis on the programme a day or two ago saying this is having a real impact on the economy. So there's that side of it for which they could be criticised. But there's exactly as you say, there's the wider thing about competence and about a sense of any kind of grip at all. And it's the opposite of what we were promised.
And the problem is it's all own goals, isn't it? So on the sort of briefings about the leaderships, there really wasn't a sort of live plot, you know, engineered by Wes Streeting or anyone else, as far as I can tell. But Downing Street then went out there and briefed it. And on the budget, you know, it was Rachel Reeves, who wasn't just kite flying, she was virtually paragliding down Whitehall with a sort of income tax rises on her back. And then sort of backing away from that at the very last minute. And it's this sense of chaos, but also weakness, actually. And what you're picking up from cabinet ministers and ministers and MPs is a exasperation, yes, anger, astonishment, but also just exactly as David Blunkett said, get a grip.
Well, we've got Lord Blunkett back. Lord Blunkett, hello.
Good morning. I didn't realise I was going to be joining the panel.
You're not joining the panel. You are very separate from it. We can
you're not
create
that. Promoted that much. We're gonna, this we're early in the morning.
We're going to create that separation, but we do want to hear what you have to say. So you were saying you're being a certain way because of the budget coming up. Please carry on.
I'm an ordinary guy, so I don't mind being part of a panel. I'm just saying that everything is so febrile that saying something quite robust might actually be unhelpful at this moment. But if people in Downing Street, and I mean the Prime Minister as well as those around him, don't understand how people see this, then they're living in a different paradigm. So,
But you're not just a normal person because of the experiences you've had in terms of when it comes to politics. You know how operations can be run well and be run badly. And what is your view of what's going wrong? Why has he not got a grip, Keir Starmer, on this?
Well, firstly, we've got two things running, haven't we? We've got the apparent paranoia. Nothing new about that. Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson, John Major, to some extent Gordon Brown when David Miliband was touting the idea of having a go. These things have happened in the past. I don't remember Downing Street actually triggering something like they did earlier this week. So that is highly unusual. And I don't know who's given assurances to Keir that they didn't do it. But it's quite clear that it was done by someone very close to him. So you need someone in charge who's not only trusted by Keir Starmer, and Morgan McSweeney is, but you need someone with substantial experience of actually managing a group of people, being highly political in terms of antennae, and being sensitive to how it will be seen outside. And I'm speaking to you from my home city of Sheffield, and one of the great advantages I always had was coming back here at the weekend and being told a thing or two. And I think some people...
So are you saying he needs to hire somebody else?
Well, they need to get out a bit, to put it mildly. And yes, I do think we need someone who's an overarching organiser of the whole operation, and to use other people's skills, which they have, in the most appropriate way. So I'm not suggesting that his long-standing friend and supporter, Morgan McSweeney, should simply be ousted, but I am saying find something that he's really good at and allow someone to come in who has the kind of skills that Jonathan Powell displayed for Tony Blair as Chief of Staff and is incidentally displaying in helping on the international front, where the Prime Minister is doing extremely well on defence and security, on trade.
Well, no, a lot of people saying he feels like a second-term Prime Minister because he's gone straight to the international stage when you do that a bit later on in your tenure, not the first year or so, where you need to be very close to home and very, you know, across domestic issues and not letting things like this happen. Lord Blunkett, did you in your time in government and in politics ever have anyone briefing against you? And did you do you have any tips to stop it? And how did you handle it?
Yes, of course I did. Normally, when someone thought you were getting a bit too big for your boots, or they were trying to disqualify you from something for the future. And what you have to do is to have really good people around you who say, stop it. You know, my advisors and my friends and family used to say, stop it. Don't be egged on by what is happening here, because if you do, then what your whole raison d'etre and what you're trying to achieve and the delivery that is the whole purpose of being there gets diverted.
So did Wes Streeting not handle it correctly by, you know, talking about it head on and saying his loyalty and saying those who have done this should be fired?
Well, I think that Keir Starmer's made it pretty clear now, hasn't he, that this isn't a style that he is prepared to accept. I'm glad he said that so clearly. It was what Wes Streeting expected him to say in that interview earlier this week on the Today programme. And I think now, if everybody's singing from the same hymn sheet, and they ought to be, we might, after 26th of November, be able to stabilise the ship. And I think we've got 3 months before we run into the local election Wales and Scottish election campaigns. Because we'll need those extra 3 months. It's 6 months to go, basically, to those crucial elections. If you don't display in the next 3 months that you've got a grip, that you understand how people feel, that you're reacting to the things that matter to them, and that you're managing and you're competent, then, of course, people will react. That's a democracy.
So 3 months, and if not, what?
And if not, then something quite serious will erupt, I think, from both the parliamentary party and beyond. Because,
as in a challenge to Keir Starmer?
Well, I don't know about challenge to Keir Starmer, but in the past, people have said, you know, who is in the public eye, who's getting the attention, and sometimes they've said, if that isn't the person who it should be, and it should be Keir Starmer and his cabinet, then they have to go. My advice,
all right,
you know, you might not take it, is for God's sake, trust your cabinet, let them get on with the job, don't have people in Downing Street second-guessing their politics, unless you believe they're better politicians than the ones you've appointed to cabinet.
You talked about having to go. Lord Blunkett, we'll let you go now. We've heard what you have to say.
Thank you very
much. We've got a good lineup. Thank you for your time this morning. And 3 months. There you go, Justin.
Yeah, go. Rachel Sylvester, of course, political editor for The Observer, still here. And now joining us on the line, Gillian Tett, Financial Times columnist, provost of King's College, Cambridge. Gillian, good morning to you.
Good morning to you as well. It's finally
raining.
Hooray.
I assume you were hearing what Lord Blunkett was saying there. This business about Jonathan Powell, he's been mentioned before to us in recent days as being a kind of model for how things should be run, in as much as he just doesn't seek anything for himself and he's not interested in briefing and counter-briefing and all the rest of it. The problem is getting there, isn't it, to the kind of people who would be willing to do that.
Well, absolutely. And John Maynard Keynes of King's College used to talk a lot about animal spirits. being absolutely critical to how the economy and the political economy works. You need to find a way to make people feel really excited and confident. And we need that desperately in the UK right now, given the state the economy's in. And unfortunately, all of these rumours and dramas are just undermining confidence and animal spirits in a much wider sense. And that's really damaging for the economy and for politics. So whoever they bring in to create a more calming, consistent and sense of proactive policy making, you know, we have to hope it's somebody who we can all admire.
Right. And that's on the people side of it. When it comes to the policy side of it, and specifically the budget, if they have now decided against income tax rises or a rise in the basic rate of income tax, and they're going for a load of smaller things across the board, I mean, in economic terms, never mind the politics of it, in economic terms, can they achieve, do you believe, what they need to achieve?
I think it's going to be tough. I always thought that they should have actually raised income taxes last year, because that's clean and simple. People can understand it, and you then don't get into endless fights with specific political groups like farmers or small business owners. And my concern is that if they're acting what they seem to be doing, a bit like a sort of CEO about to deliver annual company reports, who tells all the analysts it's going to be really bad, and then on the day it's not as bad, so everyone breathes a sigh of relief. If that's what Rachel Reeves is doing, and hoping that people start celebrating if she doesn't raise income taxes, but at the same time they have lots of fiddly small taxes, I think that's going to make people once again very irritated and politicise this and pit different groups against each other. And it also may not reassure the bond markets, because they want to see clear signs that the government has a clear, forceful framework for actually maintaining confidence in our fiscal position.
And Rachel, on the politics of the budget then, because David Blunkett seemed to be suggesting that one possible kind of reset moment is the budget. You then have a budget, it's relatively successful, it lands okay, and then you go on and do other things in the period before the local elections next year. The risk politically is it doesn't land okay.
Well, and the problem is it's become an illustration of everything that's wrong. So, you know, there's been the briefing, the pre-briefing, the kite flying, the pitch rolling, but they've rolled one pitch and they're about to bowl the ball down a totally other pitch. So I think the danger is that in terms of both the Prime Minister's authority and the sort of stability of the markets, it ends up backfiring. And, you know, the spin, is, if you like, is that this was all because the OBR produced these now fantastically better figures. And it, so Rachel Reeves wasn't going to have to raise the basic rate of income tax in the way she thought. I just don't buy that. I mean, that may be true, but I think there was already a sort of political wobble at the beginning of this week that meant that Keir Starmer was questioning whether or not he had the strength in his own party to force through these income tax rises to the basic rate. And of course, there are going to be tax rises. It's just there'll be stealth taxes rather than, you know, as Gillian says, a sort of clear rise in the basic rate.
OK, those are the headlines. This is meant to be a panel that looks at the news more roundly. And you've both of you written about interesting things that are certainly connected to these issues, but not necessarily right at the heart of them. Gillian, in your case, stablecoin.
Yes, I've written about an issue that sounds super geeky, and I dare say lots of readers will just roll their eyes and think, oh, this is either just another weird opaque corner of finance, or it's a kind of cryptocurrency thing which only kids are playing with. And the reality is that this week, Stephen Miran, who's the former Council of Economic Advisers, a very powerful position in the White House, and a Fed governor, came to Cambridge, in fact, and spoke about stable coins. And this came hard on the heels of Andrew Bailey, the Bank of England governor, talking about this. And essentially what's happening is that the White House is on a new aggressive drive for boosting dollar usage, i.e. how many people around the world use dollars, in a way that some people might think is a form of financial imperialism, or it's simply a way to try and make sure that the global financial system remains wedded to dollars. And that really matters for a country like Britain, because the reality is that America has a lot of power now. Britain's looking increasingly weak and vulnerable. And the question is, how will other countries respond?
Mm. And Rachel, you've been writing about the courts.
Yeah, so I've done an interview with Sarah Sackman, who's the courts minister, and she's talking about the how they're increasingly attracted to the idea of a new intermediate court, which would be with a judge and two magistrates rather than a jury for lots of cases. And we've got this 78,000 backlog in the Crown Courts. You've got rape victims being told their trial isn't going to be heard until 2029. It's just appalling. And I think so there does need to be radical action. The government's about to come back with its response to Sir Brian Leveson's review, which came out earlier this year, which proposed a raft of reforms. And you've got also, you know, not only are people waiting years for justice, but you've also got a fifth of the people in prison are actually on remand awaiting trial. So I think the reason why all this sort of personality stuff in Westminster is so frustrating to a lot of people, because if you're running a prison or a court or a, you know, you're a head teacher or you're trying to run a business, you see these people running around playing politics with, you know, minor things, and it's just incredibly frustrating. And I think there's a mismatch between the narrative at Westminster and what's happening in the ground. It's so important not to lose sight for these politicians of what do you want to do for the country, not what do you want to do for yourselves.
Rachel Sylvester, political editor of The Observer. Gillian Tett, author, journalist and provost of King's College, Cambridge. Thank you both.
It's 9 minutes to nine. A major announcement is expected from the government on Monday about the UK's immigration system. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, is expected to restrict the ability of people who claim asylum to stay here for the long term, and the government is also committed to closing those asylum hotels. We want to look at now how the left of centre parties across Europe are shifting their position on immigration and how that's shifting right across Europe. I'm joined now by Katja Adler, our Europe editor. Katja, how are attitudes changing across Europe?
Well, it's been a long-term shift, Emma. And I think, you know, whether it's left or right of the political spectrum, you have voters right across Europe who have been saying for a long time now that they really worry about immigration. Really exacerbated by the financial crisis of 2008-2010, people worried about jobs, job security, paying their way to the end of the month, resenting this idea that people are coming into their countries and they have to pay to look after them or so. So in an attempt to kind of claw back votes from more sort of populist right parties, if you like, that kind of set themselves up as anti-immigration or tough on immigration parties. If you think about Marine Le Pen in France, for example, you've seen the parties of the centre, including, I mean, Emmanuel Macron as president, sounding ever tougher on migration. So we've just had an election in the Netherlands, for example, and the Liberal Party D66 did extremely well in this election, but it's spoke very, very tough on immigration. We've seen Germany's Social Democrats, Germany, which had this reputation for, you know, at the time of the migrant crisis during the Syrian war back in 2015, Germany famously under Angela Merkel let in more than a million asylum seekers into the country. And just before the recent general election, you had the Social Democrats saying, no, if people come without papers to the doors of Germany claiming asylum, we really have to think about whether we let them in or not. And that, you know, that raised a lot of eyebrows. Denmark, where the UK is looking at Denmark, centre-left government there, centre-left prime minister since 2019, really, really tough on migration, to the extent that that Mette Frederiksen has been rebuked by the United Nations. But she has won popular support for taking that hard line. So, you know, we do see this right across Europe, even though I have to say on the centre-left, they are divided, because if you look at Spain, the Prime Minister there is taking a very different note, speaking very loudly about needing migrants in Spain for its economy, which is doing very well, and saying that over the next 3 years, he's going to legalise nearly a million illegal migrants in his country.
Katja Adler, our Europe editor, thank you. Going across Denmark, Spain and the changing attitudes.
And it is 5 to 9.
Oh God, I'm so lonely. An entire weekend stretching ahead with no one to love or have fun with. Anyway, I don't care. I've got a lovely steamed ginger pudding from M&S to put in the microwave. That wasn't me. That's Bridget Jones. And it turns out she's having the last laugh as a statue goes up in London's Leicester Square of her. A very good weekend indeed, alongside other fictional characters, Harry Potter and Paddington, as part of a trail celebrating a century of cinema. Helen Fielding, the creator of Bridget Jones, the writer of those words and many others, joins us now. Morning, Helen.
Good morning.
That steamed ginger pudding sounds lovely, even at 5 to 9 on a Saturday morning.
About the steamed ginger pudding, yeah.
how do you feel about this statue? And I believe it's the first to honour a romantic comedy.
Do you know what? I think it's great. I think to have a character like Bridget, who started so unassumingly, she was an anonymous column in the Independent newspaper, to have a character like that endure for 3 decades and end up as a statue in Leicester Square is wonderful. And she's just an emotionally honest, authentic, slightly messy, human, normal person, and with a great sense of humour. And I think that's very British. Mm. And to have that celebrated alongside Paddington Bear is a great honour.
An animal, a man and a woman. There you go.
Exactly. I just hope she doesn't fall over, I don't fall over, and Renee doesn't fall over in the process.
Do you know what? I was remembering the first time I interviewed you, and it was on Woman's Hour, and I was really looking forward to it. It was pretty, you know, a lot of anticipation. And I remember, you might not remember this, I remember tripping over to you in the green room and nearly spilling my tea all over you, which would have been a typical Bridget moment. And I just wondered about what it is you think that endures, because there are lots of fans who weren't even around when she was first being conceived. And even though, you know, they'll say there's problems because she talks about wanting to lose weight and certain things maybe haven't aged as well, there's still enduring love with new fans.
It is interesting that there's a new Gen Z audience. And when Bridget first took off, I didn't understand why. And after a while, I understood it was because she was touching on the gap between how we all feel we're supposed to be and how we really are inside, the side of us that we show to our friends and the people who love us just as we are. I think for the new generation, particularly of young women, it's so much harder for them with social media than it was for Bridget. They've got so many images of perfection thrown at them, filtered images, and they still worry about their shape. And on top of that, they have the body positivity movement. So secretly, they're also feeling guilty about worrying about their shape. So there's a great deal of pressure on them. And it makes me happy when they come up to me and, you know, to have their book signed if I've done an event or something. If they talk to me about how they're comforted by the idea that just being a person, being kind, being good to your friends, being good enough, being honest, and having a sense of humour and a sense of resilience, these are the important things in life, not how you present to the world.
And yet there is going to be this presentation of, in terms of a statue, just in I'm just trying to paint pictures with words here on the radio. Have you seen the statue?
I've seen a picture of it.
Any good?
Yeah, it's great. It's sort of, it's got Renee's head on it from the first movie. I think she's wearing the mummy pants because she's got a very flat stomach, but she does look really sweet. And she looks like she did in the first movie. But of course, we've followed her now through 4 films and through lots and lots of different stages in her life. And like anybody who, you know, lives through many decades, Bridget's had to surf the white notes and the black notes of life. Happy endings are just about where you choose to stop the story. But with the help of her community and the help of being able to laugh at herself when things go wrong, she